check this out, man.
People gonna rise up, take what's there. It's finally the table are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This week in radical history for the week starting September 1st. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info was found at the Daily Bleed website, and some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for September 1st, 1921, the Battle of Blair Mountain was the largest organized armed uprising in America labor history and led directly to the labor laws currently in effect in the United States of America. In a traditional fashion, President Harding would order federal troops in, and they would drop bombs from planes to end the strike. Also on September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland, start of World War II. To quote Hermann Hesse, "Of course the soldiers who die in the war are worthy of our deepest sympathy. Many of them did great things and suffered greatly, and in the end they paid with their lives. But that does not make them heroes. The common soldier, at whom an officer bellows as he would a dog, is not suddenly transformed into a hero by a bullet that kills him. To suppose that there can be millions of heroes is, of course, itself an absurdity. The obedient, well-behaved citizen who does his or her duty is not a hero. Only an individual who has fashioned his or her self-will, their noble, natural inner law, into their destiny can be a hero." Hermann Hesse. Lastly, for September 1st, 1987, protesting American arms shipments to the Contras by blocking military trains, San Francisco activist S. Brian Wilson loses both legs below the knees when the train fails to stop. Now that's a hero.
Monsieur R, Oria, Mr. Frankie, Didi la record, l'international, 2006.
This week in radical history for September 2nd, 1872, the Hague Congress of the First International is held. It is here that Marx and Engels determined it is better to kill the International than allow the growing anti-authoritarian influence to gain control. Under the thumb of Karl Marx, the Congress confirms the principal resolution of the London Conference and takes to task the anarchists and their, quote, divisive, unquote, activities, i.e. anti-authoritarian activities. It expelled the representatives, including Mikhail Bakunin, from the International on the South. Items for September 2nd, 1981, UN Human Rights Commission rules that Canadian Indian Act violates international human rights. The problem of the First Nation tribes in Canada and the gross violation of human rights and treaties throughout Canada fight on to this day. Also in 1993, San Francisco mayor starts arresting Food Not Bombs volunteers, their crime, feeding the homeless. This week in radical history for September 3rd, 1860, William Walker, a U.S. citizen who once set himself up as dictator of Nicaragua, invades Honduras with his own private army. Once he arrives, he reestablishes slavery. Also on September 3rd, 1897, Emma Goldman begins lecture tour in Providence, Rhode Island, and speaks at two open-air meetings attended by thousands. The then-mayor warns Goldman that she'll be arrested if she speaks at open-air meeting again. Despite the prohibition, Emma continues to lecture. Speaking of Red Emma, 12 years later in 1909, the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, prevents Emma Goldman from speaking anywhere in his city. Accompanied by Ben Reitman, Emma is attempting to exercise her supposed free speech rights in a short lecture tour in Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, and is harassed nonstop everywhere she goes. Also on September 3rd, 1915, Australia, Wobbly Tom Barker is arrested for his anti-war poster. Quote, "Workers, follow your masters, stay at home," unquote. Anti-recruiting efforts finally gave him 12 months of hard labor, but he quickly released within 3 months following a series of fires in stores and factories. No cause and effect there at all. Also on this date in 1954, the Espionage and Sabotage Act authorizes the death penalty for peacetime sabotage. Also, Congress passes a bill to revoke the citizenships of persons convicted of conspiracy to overthrow the government. These laws that are so loosely worded that governmental abuse of this law abounds. Also on September 3, 1974, former Nixon attorney John Dean enters prisons for the Watergate crimes. Now he's a criminal attorney, proving once again that once you're in the team, you'll do fine, like criminals such as Ollie North or war criminal Henry Kissinger. Do the crime and you'll do just fine. Also on this date in 1991, 25 workers die in a fire at the Imperial Food Processing Plant, Hamlet, North Carolina. 19 were single mothers. A non-union plant, it had not been inspected by the federal or state agencies for 11 years. Despite 3 minor fires earlier in the year and other obvious dangers, the fire exits remained locked. One of the worst disasters of its kind, reminiscent of the Triangle Garment Factory fire in the early 1900s. Also on this date in 2001, South Africa, U.S. and Israel walk out of U.N. conference on racism. Of course they would. Lastly, for September 3, 2003, thousands log on to blow up a virtual bush. This online game, pitting defecating peace doves, the player, against American President George W. Bush, is attracting thousands of play a day, including American government departments. Launched last week by the South African student website Get a Life. Quote, "We're able to monitor where the hits are coming from," says Andy Hadfield of Get a Life. He adds, "The game is very popular in Germany, England, South Africa, and France. You win when Bush explodes into a nuclear mushroom, or lose when Rumsfeld's missiles hit your pooping doves once too often."
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, September 4th, in 1781, a group of 46 settlers founded the city of Los Angeles, 12 years after the Spanish began their conquest and occupation of California. 40 years later, Mexico took control of the city after having gained their independence from Spain, 25 years after it was snatched up by the United States in their quest for manifest destiny. The American city of Los Angeles later became the setting for events such as the exclusion and internment of Japanese American citizens, the Watts riots, the mass criminalization of people of color, intense gang violence, and the destructive crack epidemic. I wonder how things might have been had Spain and Europe stayed on their side of the Atlantic. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for September 4th, 1886, legendary Apache surrenders to General Nelson Miles at Skeleton Canyon, Arizona, ending the last major U.S.-Indian conflict. Geronimo led a small band of men, women, and children out of a forced internment camp on the San Carlos Reservation, successfully evading thousands of U.S. and Mexican troops over the next 18 months in the Southwest Wilderness. Also on September 4, 1903, Cripple Creek, Colorado, where mine owners are trying to bust a labor union, as police and deputy sheriffs are relieved their duties and all citizens are required to register their firearms, as Governor Peabody sends in the militia. Then in 1904, they seize a local sympathetic newspaper and round up strikers into bullpens and take them to the Kansas border and abandon them. General Sherman Bell of the Colorado National Guard shouted, "Habeas corpus, hell, we'll give them postmortems." This week in Radical History for September 5th, 1877, Great Sioux warrior Crazy Horse is murdered. Crazy Horse and his starving people had peacefully surrendered to U.S. Army on May 6th. Crazy Horse was assassinated on orders of a local reservation agent, bayoneted in the back by U.S. soldiers while in custody at Fort Robinson, Nebraska. Also on September 5, 1882, first American Labor Day observed, 30,000 workers march in parade sponsored by the New York City Central Labor Union. Also on that date in 1911, pupils desert the classroom and parade in the streets after a Lily boy is punished for passing around a note urging his friends to strike against corporal punishment. In the next fortnight, schools in over 60 major towns and cities will come out in solidarity.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
Also on that date in 1917, the Palmer Raids begin. Federal agents attack Industrial Workers of the World, IWW halls and offices in 48 cities across the nation. Federal agents conduct coordinated raids, seizing records, destroying equipment and books, arresting hundreds of wobbly activists for the crime of labor organizing and, quote, obstructing, unquote, World War I. This is done without warrants and with total disregard for civil liberties and legal rights. In December of 1919, the Palmer agents gathered 249 people of Russian origin, including well-known radical leaders such as Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, and placed them on a ship bound for the Soviet Union. During one of the raids, more than 4,000 individuals were rounded up in a single night. All foreign aliens caught were deported, with no requirement that there be any evidence against them under the provision of the Anarchist Act. All in all, by January of 1920, Palmer and Hoover had organized the largest mass arrest in U.S. history, rounding up at least 10,000 individuals. Two more items for September 5th, 1989. George Bush I announces a $7.9 billion anti-drug plan. George uses a bag of crack purchased across the street from the White House as a prop to show how ambiguous drugs are. Later, it was revealed that a DEA agent had to lure a drug dealer there. Why he didn't score the crack from his drug-using son, George II, is unknown. Lastly, for September 5th, 2005, Common Ground Collective offers solidarity, not charity, to survivors of the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. They are the first and for a long time the only aid group in the devastated New Orleans area and harassed by cops for weeks.
I went down to New Orleans with some residents and activists of that devastated area. I plugged into the Common Ground Collective.
Of all the problems of racism and classism that were existing down here before, what happened down here was whole series of human rights violations against people of the Gulf Coast perpetrated by the city, state, and federal governments in conjunction with many national and international-based relief organizations.
That lack of organization from the government and what they're kind of where they're falling through, what you've seen where they fall through at?
Well, from what I've seen, it seems to be very bureaucratic in terms of getting supplies to any of the relief centers. You have to be able to prove your ID of residency. You need to prove that you're from the area, and most people have lost most of the paperwork since Katrina and Rita hit. Go to a federally run relief center, your chances of getting supplies are next to nothing.
It's a class war that's being waged down here. Folks around the country have to remember that just because, you know, CNN or Fox News is saying, oh, all services are 100% open down here, that's a crock of and it's a matter of blatant lies being perpetrated against the people of New Orleans saying, oh, they're all hunky-dory now with their whole neighborhoods that don't have power, that don't have water.
Between the military checkpoints and the curfews that would change on a whim of the authorities, the curfews, you'd get a different answer whoever you asked because there were no military. There were no police here in some places for the first 3, 6 to 8 days. There was none of that presence on the ground. And then as soon as the military was here, they were acting like the checkpoints were necessary to keep out looters. I was like, you missed the boat. You're too late. You're lying. You're hypocritical. You're just wrong.
It's really important that people get down here if they can. I mean, this is a place where people are needed. I know the Red Cross and FEMA are saying they don't need more bodies. And the reason that they're saying that is because they don't want people coming down here. They don't want people to know what they're doing. They don't want people to see the atrocities that are being committed every day. They don't want people to see the damage. They don't want people to really realize the war that's being waged right now, the war for New Orleans that's being fought.
Had been intimidated to force to give over her key. And her and her 4 children were out on the street, and she was crying. We can't get in contact with that woman. We wish we could. So here we've got these landlords that are going around the law, bullying, intimidating, bluffing people out. Construction crews over here, contractors, all these things. And they're telling 75-year-old women that they might get hit by trucks. It's just, you know, veiled threats. And
around here, I look in an apartment. They say $1,000 for deposit, $1,000 for rent. I am a person clean house. The people not come back yet. I don't have enough money for pay that apartment's very expensive for me. I don't have place to go.
The need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the Ninth Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So thanks again for all your efforts, and Common Ground's an awesome place, and I hope people get a chance to come down and check it out. And
this is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, September 6th, in 1876, race riots erupted in Charleston, South Carolina, after a hostile encounter between two opposing political parties. This occurred toward the end of the Reconstruction era when many black citizens were intensely frustrated by the government's failed attempts at racial equality. That night, in Charleston, a crowd of progressive black organizations armed themselves and confronted a group of black conservative politicians who they felt betrayed their race. When a number of whites attempted to interfere and side with the black conservatives, the crowd grew angry and set out on a two-day rampage, assaulting white people in the streets, resulting in the death of one white man. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Lately, given the events at Charlottesville and all its fallout, and given the Trump administration's ongoing aid and comfort to the right-wing racist, fascist, and militia movements, we hear of the increased open expressions of racism and anti-Semitism throughout American society. Most of us think that these racist and anti-Semitic expressions are attacks on a separate people, but that is not necessarily the case. Take the case of Leslie Williams, an Afro-American of the Jewish faith. Obviously, she has unique experiences and a unique take on what is happening on our streets and in our communities. I'm going to read the text of a speech given by Leslie Williams at a call to renewed action against racism and neo-fascism held by the Resist, Reimagine, Rebuild Coalition of Chicago. Leslie spoke on behalf of Jewish Voice for Peace, Chicago, one of the member organizations of the coalition. Here is what she said, and I offer it because it is both thought-provoking and profound, speaks to the intersectionality we need to promote, and exposes concepts we need to deal with in this society, including the inclusion of the Palestinian struggle for their country in this discourse. Leslie Williams said in her speech, and I quote, "I stand here today as a Jew by choice and the child and grandchild of the great migration in which millions of African Americans fled racist terror in the South, only to encounter redlining, discrimination, and police violence in the North and the Midwest. Like all of you, I have mourned and raged over the overt racism and anti-Semitism seen in Charlottesville. I have watched in horror as avowed racists defiantly parade in Klan robes and swastikas. I have listened to the anguish of Holocaust survivors and their descendants as they are forced to confront the historic trauma of the Nazi era. As both a Jew and an African American, I recoil from the white supremacy and anti-Semitism on display this week. I have been gratified to hear Jewish leaders and organizations call for the destruction of racism, speaking eloquently about the shared history of oppression Jews and African Americans have faced. Yes, I confess to a certain discomfort in the many appeals to recognize the twin evils of anti-Semitism and anti-black racism in Charlottesville. I've thought about this a lot over the past week, and here's what I've realized. For Jews, Nazi symbols evoke a terrifying, traumatic past. For African Americans, they evoke a terrifying, traumatic, unending present. White Jews may be shocked at this undeniable evidence of U.S. racism. African Americans merely see more of the same. Black people did not need to be reminded by hoods and swastikas that we live in a dangerously racist country. White Jews are not under the same level of threat as people of color. In short, white Jews need to accept that they are white and that whatever harassments or humiliation they may experience from anti-Semites, they nevertheless dwell under the all-encompassing shelter of white privilege. Police do not murder them in custody. Their votes are not systematically undermined. They do not overwhelmingly live in poverty or adjacent to poverty. The two documented lynchings of American Jews, though horrific, pale in comparison to the nearly 4,000 lynchings of black women, men, and children in U.S. history. The lifestyle and life expectancy of the average white Jewish American is not materially different from that of white non-Jewish majority. There is no institutional anti-Semitism. Furthermore, white America is generally more accepting of discussing and acknowledging the history of anti-Semitism than they are the currency of anti-black racism. As James Baldwin wrote in the classic 1967 essay, one does not wish, in short, to be told by an American Jew that his suffering is as great as the American Negro's suffering. For it is not here, and not now, that the Jew is being slaughtered. The Jewish travail occurred across the sea, and America rescued him from the house of bondage. But America is the house of bondage for the Negro, and no country can rescue him. For white Jewish Americans, the U.S. has always been the promised land. Yet African Americans know it is Pharaoh's Egypt. Not only do white Jews of good conscience need to acknowledge that they are not the primary victims of white supremacy, they need to look at how their own institutions have not only failed to challenge, but in some cases are openly complicit in its preservation. For example, the Anti-Defamation League, which presents itself as a champion of civil rights and tolerance, once spied against the NAACP and the African National Congress. A 1993 lawsuit regarding the ADL's extensive spying on Muslim, Arab, anti-apartheid, and other political activists also reveals that the ADL spied on and passed information to South African authorities on African National Congress leader Chris Hani shortly before his assassination. As JVP points out in our Deadly Exchange campaign, the ADL and other Jewish organizations like the American Jewish Congress, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and Chicago's own Jewish United Fund all organize police, ICE, and Homeland Security training exchanges in which American and Israeli police officers share tactics of oppression, teaching each other the aggressive, militarized police strategies which have led to the deaths of African Americans like Philando Castile, Freddie Gray, and Laquan McDonald, and Palestinians such as Mahmoud Khalif Lafe, Omar Ahmed Lufti Khalil, and Shiham Rateb Rashid Nimar. Meanwhile, according to their own tax filings, many cities' Jewish federations, including Chicago's Jewish United Fund, contribute generously to groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified as leading anti-Muslim extremists. Groups like the Middle East Forum and the Investigative Project on Terror, which laid the intellectual groundwork for Trump's Muslim ban. It is no coincidence that these groups are all tremendously supportive of Israel's brutal policies toward Palestinians. All of this is done in the name of Jewish security, either in the United States or in Israel. So I ask my white Jewish friends and family, is the perceived safety of people who look like you worth the continued oppression, incarceration, and murder of people who look like me? Last summer, when African Americans challenged white America to support the platform for Black Lives, nearly every Jewish organization in the country condemned its indictment of the genocidal oppression experienced by Palestine in Israel. None was more critical, dismissive, and patronizing than Jonathan Greenblatt, the president of the ADL, who urged African Americans to, quote, keep our eyes on the prize, unquote, and remember that it is Jews, not African Americans, who know from genocide. I hope that the obscenity of Charlottesville will lead all Americans to examine their complicity in tolerating institutional oppression. But in particular, Jewish Voice for Peace calls on our own Jewish community to condemn and disavow our organizational support of racism and Islamophobia, both past and present. We must embrace a vision for safety that does not come at the expense of communities of color. Only then can we truly claim to stand together in genuine, rather than merely symbolic, solidarity. That was a speech delivered at a rally in Chicago by Leslie Williams, an Afro-American of the Jewish faith and a member of Jewish Voice for Peace. Okay, now on to our feature presentation. This morning we feature a speech given by Columbia University Professor Rashid Khalidi during Columbia's Anti-Apartheid Week, beginning March 1st, 2017. His topic, Palestine in the Age of Trump. First, the introduction, followed by the presentation.
So thank you so much for coming out to Columbia University Apartheid Day's third event of our annual Israeli Apartheid Week. I'm going to introduce our speaker. So Professor Rashid Al-Khalidi is the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia University. From 1987 to 2003, he was a professor of Middle East History and a director of the Center for International Studies at the University of Chicago, where he taught. So without further ado, can we give a warm welcome to a very special speaker, Professor Rashid Al-Khalidi.
Thank you. With a government firmly in power in Washington today that has a profound and deep disdain for Palestinian rights, and that is far closer to the right-wing leadership of Israel than any administration that has come before it, I think that Palestine currently confronts a very daunting reality, Palestine and the Palestinian people. Now, this is not entirely new. In recent years, the ascendant political currents in the United States and in Israel had already begun to merge. I would argue that in some ways, we are almost one country. There's been an ever-increasing flow from one country to another in both directions of political consultants, political operatives, public relations expertise, campaign contributions, security and intelligence expertise, high-tech firms, capital, investment, and many, many other things. U.S. laws are increasingly made according to Israeli desiderata. The Israel lobby often kindly provides the drafts of these laws, which overburdened members of the House and Senate frequently adapt and pass unchanged. They once mistakenly actually tabled a bill, I believe it was in the House, which the facts of AIPAC and its address were at the top, and they just put it down as a member's bill. It was actually an AIPAC bill. It was passed, of course. Politicians have long proclaimed that the values of the two countries are identical, American and Israeli values are identical, and that there cannot and must not be any daylight at all between their policies. Their policies must be identical. So we're not the same country quite yet, but these are indicators of the fact that the currents, the leading or the dominant political countries, currents in both countries are, in fact, beginning to merge. I'm arguing tonight that this process has now reached its apogee under those perfectly suited soulmates, Donald J. Trump and Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu. Both men harbor pronounced authoritarian tendencies. Both have a contempt for legal niceties. Both are hostile towards the role of the press in a free society. And both have a barely concealed racism towards the minorities in their respective countries. Both are inveterate bullies who regularly employ the language of threat, force, and bluster. We're probably more familiar with our own president, but both of them really are similar in all of these respects. They are supported, sustained politically, and advised by members of the same class of reactionary billionaires, with casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, perhaps the most prominent individual on that long list. He's one of the biggest supporters of Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's one of the biggest supporters of President Trump. And he certainly is a reactionary billionaire, though Trump has a long list of them, many of them now cabinet secretaries. Once upon a time, it wasn't that long ago, America's solicitous concern for Israel and its casual disregard for the Palestinians was deceptively cloaked behind a pretense of even-handedness. Once upon a time. It's almost a fairy tale now. Today, under Trump, we're already seeing an even more complete convergence between the U.S. political leadership and the most chauvinistic, the most religious, the most settler-dominated right-wing government in Israel's entire 68-year history. It will be this Israeli government, and it will be its new American partners in Washington, who will attempt to call the tune in Palestine for the next several years. Now, we were able to get a glimpse of the future that these two sides, the Trump administration and the Netanyahu government, envision for Palestine and the Palestinians during the recent Trump-Netanyahu joint press conference in Washington. Standing at a podium alongside the podium of the president, the prime minister stated that in any peace agreement, I'm quoting him now, Israel must retain the overriding security control over the entire area west of the Jordan River. Now, Netanyahu has long affirmed that he would only allow the Palestinians what he called a state minus. He's long affirmed that most of the illegal Israeli settlements established since 1967 must remain in place, that all of Jerusalem belongs to Israel alone, and that Israel must keep somewhere between 50 and 60% of the West Bank, including the fertile Jordan River Valley. Boiled down to their essence, all of these statements translate into a regime of permanent occupation and colonization of what remains of Palestine. What is done with the Palestinians is secondary in this vision. As, and this is, I think, important, as Netanyahu laid out his preconditions, this was the main one, there was one other, recognition of a Jewish state, Israel as a Jewish state, as he laid out his preconditions for a settlement that effectively ruled out a sovereign Palestinian state during this press conference, President Trump did not demur. He didn't object. He didn't say a word. Nor did he object when Netanyahu absurdly segued from biblical history to the colonial practice of the modern nation state of Israel. He wiped out 50 years of illegal occupation and land theft in the West Bank by saying, airily, this is Netanyahu speaking now, Jews are called Jews because they come from Judea. Jews are not foreign colonialists in Judea. So there's no occupation, there's no settlement, there's no colonization. This is people returning home to their ancestral land, and you can't object. The president said nothing, of course. Now, there is much, much more in the Trump-Netanyahu agenda for Palestine that is troubling. Though I've written in some of the op-eds that I've published since in the last couple of weeks that some of these things actually offer opportunities if people only know how to take them. But I think that on balance, much of this is troubling. But I want to stress tonight that not all the challenges faced by the Palestinians are going to come from increased collusion between the United States and Israel. The Palestinians are going to face challenges from within their own ranks. The entire Palestinian political and economic structure that was set up in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip since the 1993 Oslo Accords, which is a very long time now, if you think about it, 1993, 2017. This entire structure was predicated on the idea that it would evolve into the framework for a genuine, viable, contiguous, and sovereign Palestinian state. That was 24 years ago. That illusion that that would happen, which was held by many Palestinians and is clung to by others to this day, is now in tatters. It's very hard to believe that. Creation of this entire flawed political structure was also based on the naive premise that the United States had a vital interest in moderating Israeli behavior. That's clearly no longer the case under Trump, and that the United States had an interest in achieving a modicum of justice in the Middle East. Those premises, too, in my view, have been eroded by decades of bitter experience, and I think most people realize that the emperor is stark naked, whatever the emperor and his friend say. The Palestinian Authority that was set up by the Oslo Accords, ostensibly as part of an interim arrangement for Palestinian self-rule, it was supposed to go into extinction in 1997-98. There was not supposed to be something called a Palestinian Authority. There were supposed to be final status negotiations, which were to have led to permanent resolution of all outstanding questions, Jerusalem, water, settlements, borders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That did not happen. So this is an interim arrangement that has lasted now for 24 years. Far from serving the interests of the Palestinian people, this interim arrangement, in my view and in the view of many others, will continue to do them more harm than good. Few people understand, I think, that the continuing colonization of Palestinian land and the maintenance of what is going to become a 50-year-old military occupation in June, the longest occupation in modern history, would not be sustainable today without American, Israeli, and European sponsorship of the PA and the PA's U.S.-trained security forces. The PA's criminalization of any form of resistance, peaceful or otherwise, to Israel's colonization and what is now clearly a permanent military occupation have made it, in effect, a tool of collaboration with that occupation. The way that this ostensibly Palestinian institution, in fact, it's not a Palestinian institution. It's a Palestinian institution to the extent that the Gurkhas were a Nepalese institution or that Harkis were an Algerian institution. They were institutions of a colonial army which used them for whatever purposes Britain used the Gurkhas or France used the Harkis in Algeria. So the way this ostensibly Palestinian institution operates against its own people provides a preview of the future that both Israeli and American officials now foresee for the Palestinians in the occupied territories, a future that is constricted, controlled, and void of sovereignty and self-determination. It's clear that the United States in the age of Trump and Israel in the age of Netanyahu will only work to strengthen this oppressive regime. They do not seem to have any interest in dismantling it or even moderating it. No help. So how could this change if we have an Israeli and an American leadership that are growing closer together and both have moved their countries considerably to the right in recent years? I would argue that no help can be expected from the Arab world, most of whose undemocratic regimes do not represent their peoples. There are varying degrees of support for the Palestinians in different Arab countries, but in any case, their regimes don't represent them. And those that do have sympathy for the Palestinians are not really able to express that sympathy. This is especially true this situation, given the failure of hopes for democratization that erupted at the beginning of the decade, and given the collapse of any form of pan-Arab solidarity. The Arab world is racked not only by external intervention, but by internal proxy wars, where one Gulf principality is fighting another Gulf principality via the intermediary of Libyans or via the intermediary of Syrians or whatever, or where Gulf countries are engaged in much more seriously in opposing Iran than they are in doing anything else. Meanwhile, the absolute monarchies in the Gulf are moving ever closer to Israel. This is becoming closer and closer to an overt alliance, while Syria, Iraq, Libya, and Yemen are torn by a combination of civil wars and proxy wars, where external powers manipulate local actors. Far from offering hope to the Palestinians, this dismal regional configuration, and I haven't even talked about terrorism. I haven't even talked about ISIS. I could talk about even more gloomy things if you want me to. Far from offering hope to the Palestinians, this dismal regional configuration only strengthens this Israeli government's hegemonic ambitions and its arrogance. In a region of total disarray, Israel stands as an even more powerful actor. In this grim context, I'm arguing tonight, the Palestinians face very stark choices. One option is to just muddle on. And for the moment, that's how their leadership, at least, seems to intend to proceed. Another option is for them to submit openly to the dictates of Washington and Tel Aviv, which on past form is just not going to happen. Whatever the leaderships want to do, I don't think most Palestinians will go along if what the leaderships want to do is to capitulate. The only other option, in my view, is for the Palestinians to rebuild their fractured national movement, which is in a state of complete disarray, probably in the worst shape it's been in since 1948, and to thoroughly redefine their objectives and their strategies and their modes of resistance to oppression. As many have argued, many Palestinians in the occupied territories and outside have argued, it's time for them to abandon the failed experiment of the PA, time for them to abandon the pretense of negotiation with an Israeli government that's interested only in dictating its own terms, and to abandon all forms of violence whose only effect is to harden the sway of the right wing over Israeli politics. If you sum up the policies of Fatah in Ramallah and Hamas in Gaza, they're doing these things that I've said have to be abandoned. It's time, moreover, to mobilize the vast energies, inventiveness, and capital of the Palestinian diaspora and of Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, who, by the way, are the Palestinians who understand best how Israel functions and what it is really up to. And it's time, finally, to stop thinking of Palestine as solely those small fragments that have been under Israeli occupation since 1967. On the conceptual level, and this is something that is incumbent not just on Palestinians, I think, but also on their supporters, it's time for people who advocate for Palestinian rights to learn that in struggles against both colonial settler regimes and racist systems like Jim Crow in the American South, the key to a successful approach was a laser-like focus on rights and equality. I cannot stress this enough. Equally important, it is time to stop mouthing empty slogans about a one-state solution and to begin to work out in detail the ways in which Palestinians and Israelis can finally be able to coexist in complete equality in a country they will ultimately have to share once it is free of the domination of one group over the other. In such a scenario, it is essential that the exercise of individual or group rights not impinge on or be at the expense of the rights of others, whether they are civil rights, human rights, religious rights, property rights, or national rights. There is no place in that small country for one group to say, our national rights take precedence over everything else. That is simply not going to work. Leave aside immoral, leave aside there's no basis for it, leave aside any other grounds for criticism. It won't work. You can't impose that. It's not possible to say, these people have these civil rights, these people have these, or this group of people, or these individuals, these property rights, these religious rights, and these people don't. You can't do that in the 21st century. You could do it in the 18th century. You could do it in the 19th century. But Israel is the outcome of a colonial project whose roots lie at a time when you could do that, when colonial was a good thing. There was a colonial office, the British colonial office. There was a school of Oriental and African studies which trained people for the British colonies. There's a French school, it still exists, that trained people for the French colonies. That was then. This is now. You can't do that anymore. And that, in effect, is part of the struggle. And it, revealing it as such, explaining it as such, addressing it as such, finding solutions to it in those terms, I think changes the entire way in which one looks at things. Now, this shift to a rights-based, equality-based approach can occur under various rubrics. And it doesn't matter which rubric is chosen, whether this involves binationalism, one state, two states, three states, doesn't matter, cantons, separate quasi-states, regional confederations, any other number of formulae are acceptable. The details are important. I'm not trying to dismiss that. But the key to such a future will have to be absolute equality of rights and of burdens for all members of both peoples, and that will involve ironclad constitutional and possibly international protection for these rights. Now, it's easy to say these things, and very hard, obviously, to implement them, but they require a sort of paradigm shift, which is absolutely necessary if we're going to ever get out of the rut that we're in. It's going to be very hard to devise such a blueprint, and it will be very hard to rally the support for it of the various segments of the Palestinian people inside the country and in exile. Most Palestinians don't live inside historic Palestine. Most of them live in exile. Most of them live in places like Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, other Arab countries, Chile, the United States, 250,000 of them in Chile, 250,000 of them in the United States. Maybe, we don't know the numbers, but there are a lot of them outside, and there are many of them inside. And they have different, you know, orientations, and getting their consensus around something like this is not going to be very easy. Many of them are committed to the idea of an independent Palestinian state, which is understandable because Palestinians have never enjoyed sovereignty in their own country. They've been constantly denied it throughout the last century. Equally difficult will be to convey this argument, this idea, in a convincing fashion to Arab, international, and most importantly to Israeli audiences. Only if both peoples can be convinced that they have a future in Palestine and Israel with equal rights and which is free of the oppression of one by the other will it be possible to change the dynamic that has prevailed between these peoples as they became peoples in the 20th century for about a century. Only after this difficult effort can be launched can we really imagine the Palestinians envisaging a future free of oppression, and only after this sign of a process has been launched can there be a hope of real peace and of real security, not security imposed by force with the stronger, using the bayonet and walls and legal stratagems to force, impose security, quote unquote, but real security and real peace is dependent on moving in this direction. Now, having thoroughly depressed you by offering you a gloomy picture of the situation and telling you that to get out of this, you know, we have to do something that's almost impossible, let me lighten things up a little bit. Because having, you know, depressed you and having indicated how very hard it's going to be to get out of this rut, I want to suggest that there are actually clear signs of change and real reasons for hope, at least in the United States and Europe. Let me explain. The change that I'm talking about is evidenced in an entirely new spirit where Palestine is concerned. Now, I'm old compared to most of you, and I remember the days when to use the word Palestine was a contested and difficult thing, an impossible thing in some environments. I mean, it would lead to violence in some environments. And so when I say an entirely new spirit where Palestine is concerned, I'm talking with a certain historical memory, and it's a historical memory that's based on the memory of my parents who were involved in advocacy in New York City in the 40s when it was even harder than when I was a university student or a graduate student. The change that I'm talking about it can be witnessed on campuses, in many churches and some synagogues, in unions, in the publishing industry. Think about what's being published on Palestine. If you have any idea what was published 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, if you go back and look at how many books actually dealt with Palestine in an objective fashion a generation ago, you would be astonished at what has changed in just the American and British publishing industries. Even in the increasingly important non-mainstream media, there have been incredibly important changes with access to information that simply was unavailable a decade or two ago. Compared to a generation ago, we are at an entirely new place as far as discourse on Palestine is concerned. Now, ignorance, bigotry, and resistance haven't disappeared. You can sample it on the way out of Butler Library if you want. But 20 years ago, pretty much all that existed in American public life, or 30 years ago, pretty much all that existed in American public life, where Palestine was concerned, was ignorance, bigotry, and resistance. My point is, there is a lot else today. You can have access to real facts. You can actually learn about the situation there in ways that simply was not possible a generation or two ago. Today, there is much more openness to hearing other points of view. There is much more knowledge of the real situation in Palestine. If anybody has doubts, and they're reachable, say to them, go to Hebron and spend 6 hours. Any part of Hebron, it doesn't matter where or with whom. I mean, go with somebody who can protect you, but go to Hebron. Just spend 6 hours there. And if you're a sentient human being, you will come back changed. Because that in a microcosm is what's going on in the entire country. It's much worse in Hebron than in Nablus. It's worse in Nablus than it is in the little bubble of Ramallah, which is protected from reality in many ways. But that is the core of it in a certain way. And people are doing that. I mean, I know people, conventional, conservative, liberal members of the consensus in Chicago, people, Chicagoans I knew, who went there, and they were just gobsmacked, to use the British expression. They came back changed people. I know many, many people. You can do that now. It's possible. And more people are doing it or are accessing real information about the real situation, not propaganda, actual information that enables them to make up their minds and to come to new understandings of things. There is also a dawning realization. I mean, we're now living in the age of Trump, and it's depressing to think that what was happening a year ago or 2 years ago or appeared to be happening a year ago or 2 years ago insofar as issues around racism, minorities, African Americans, Native Americans, seems to be reversed. But those changes are irreversible in some respects. They're still there underneath the veneer that's going to be laid over them by this administration. There is a dawning realization that what Palestinians face has similarities. It's not identical, but it has similarities to past liberation struggles, not only to past liberation struggles in South Africa and elsewhere, but also to the efforts of Native Americans and African Americans to confront deep-seated prejudice and oppression. These are powerful new ways of understanding that are seeping into American public consciousness. And it's not every American who sees this, but it is a growing phenomenon. In addition, and I think this is actually important, in addition, the rise of a new wave of overt anti-Semitism that is one of the most dismal features of the age of Trump, and it is part of the age of Trump. This didn't just happen. This happened because of what was unleashed during this electoral campaign and by this new administration. The rise of this new wave of overt anti-Semitism is forcing many people to make connections that they never made before. This is forcing them to look askance at spurious accusations of anti-Semitism directed at proponents of Palestinian rights. When real old-fashioned Jew hatred is being expressed almost daily via, for example, swastikas in the New York City subways, via attacks on Jewish cemeteries where hundreds of tombstones are overturned, via bomb threats to Jewish community institutions. It is absurd, it's actually obscene, that some people whose concern this is focus, instead of these outrages, these real anti-Semitic outrages, on shielding Israel's occupation and its colonization by falsely tarring people who oppose these things with the brush of anti-Semitism. And that connection is being made by a lot of ordinary people who don't think a lot about Palestine, but they know what anti-Semitism is. And when somebody says, well, somebody who is in favor of BDS is an anti-Semite, and that person happens to be Jewish, and you have actual anti-Semitic bigots drawing swastikas and knocking over tombstones, they say, that's the real thing. People are not stupid. They actually understand that. And I've talked to so many people who have
very little commitment one way or another on this issue, but they make this connection. This spurious use of anti-Semitism is going to snare the people who are using it. And that's a really good thing. It's one of the only good things to come out of this horrible wave of anti-Semitism. Now, if you needed confirmation of the profound shift that is taking place in American attitudes towards Palestine and Israel, if you needed that, you only have to look at the signs that come from the secular religion of most Americans. Most Americans claim to be religious. This is a very religious country. But their real religion is actually football. Okay, whether they go to a synagogue or a church or a mosque or a temple or whatever, whatever they may do on a Friday or Saturday or Sunday or whatever, most of them, really, they worship at the temple of Sunday afternoon. I mean, that's really where they're, you know, hooked. You will have noticed that 12 football players were booked to go on a propaganda tour of Israel recently. Seven of the 12 declined to do so, because in the words of one of them, Michael Bennett, the man who I think was the leader of this, "I will not be used," he said, "by the Israeli government." Now, this is an echo of something that came up in a recent film on James Baldwin, "I am not your Negro." That's what Bennett was saying. You're not going to use me. You're not going to take me there, take me on a magical mystery tour, and turn me into a shill, which is what Israeli government ministers said they were going to do. And Bennett, not being stupid, read it and said, "No, you're not." And he carried the majority of this group with him. I think that reveals the way that things are beginning to come together in the American public imaginary. What Israel does to the Palestinians is increasingly being seen as akin to Jim Crow, as akin to apartheid, and the call for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions are regarded as comparable to earlier boycotts in Montgomery, in Greensboro, and, of course, in South Africa. And those connections are just not that hard to make. You know, boycott is as American as apple pie. The Boston Tea Party was a boycott. They were tossing tea overboard because they were objecting to King George sticking a tax on it. It was a violent boycott. Heaven forbid. I'm not advocating violence of any sort or destruction of property. Heaven forfend. But that was a boycott. That's a founding event in the American psyche, folks. Boycott is as American as, I don't know, tea in Boston Harbor. Now, you might say these are just signs, you know, Michael Bennett, whatever. But I think that the changes, these changes in public discourse, are actually cumulatively beginning to produce an appreciable effect on public opinion. This is true, although where Palestine is concerned, the positions of much of the mainstream media and the positions of both the Democratic and Republican Party leaderships, the establishments of both parties, are frozen in the dark ages. They have not evolved, the Democratic leadership, the Republican leadership, the mainstream media. But there is evidence, whatever the politicians say, whatever Congress says, and Congress pretty much says whatever AIPAC wants, in spite of this, there's evidence that American public opinion is rapidly shifting away from uncritical support for Israel, and that Americans are becoming increasingly sympathetic to the cause of Palestinian freedom. According to a poll that was released by the Brookings Institution in December of last year, 60% of Democrats and 46% of all Americans support sanctions or stronger actions against Israel over its construction of illegal Jewish settlements on occupied Palestinian land. Savor those numbers. 46% of all Americans polled by Brookings. 60% of Democrats. The numbers are up from 49% and 37%. Respectively, in 2015. That is a remarkable increase and quite striking. There's no way to predict whether that trend would continue, but it is an important trend. Even more striking, a Pew poll released a little more than a month ago, in January, found that for the first time ever, the percentage of Democrats who side with the Palestinians is about equal to those who side with Israel. Think about that. The party that got 3 million more votes in spite of running a very unpopular candidate has now an equal number of party members who are as supportive of Palestine as there are party members who are supportive of Israel. That's quite, I think, quite striking. While liberal Democrats, people who self-identify as liberal Democrats, sympathize more with the Palestinians than with Israelis by a margin of 38% to 26%. Now, what does all this mean? It means that the base of the Democratic Party is out of tune, or put differently, the party leadership is out of tune with the base of the Democratic Party, because the party leadership is, first of all, is made up of older people. The base is made up of younger people. The leadership is wider. The base is more diverse. But it's also because the party leadership is beholden to big donors who've had a bigger and bigger influence on the party since Bill and Hillary Clinton founded the Democratic Leadership Council in 1985. Sounds like somebody's having fun. Okay. I'm almost done, guys. Now, all of this is occurring, we have to admit, at a time when the Republican Party, and its base especially, have become more and more supportive of Israel than ever before. They're driven in part by evangelical Christians who form an important part of the base of the Republican Party. Even while most of the Democratic Party establishment mouths the same stale pieties about Israel as before, there has in fact been a marked decrease in the bipartisan nature of public support for Israel. We could see this when Netanyahu inserted himself into American electoral politics with the connivance of Romney, who began to launched a campaign event actually in Israel side by side with Netanyahu, and Netanyahu coming to speak before Congress twice at the invitation of the Republicans in an insult to the president. This has decreased the bipartisan nature of support for Israel. Nevertheless, for the moment, with Republicans in control of the White House and in control of both houses of Congress, this means that Netanyahu can breathe easily. When that ceases to be the case, when Republicans no longer control both houses, when Republicans no longer control the White House, whenever that may be, as the Democratic Party base asserts itself against the unresponsive and unrepresentative leadership of the party on this issue, that situation could change dramatically. So what is a soothing situation for partisans of Israeli colonization, Israeli settlement, Israeli occupation, will be a lot less comforting. Over time, one can hope, these changes will eventually filter up to politicians and policymakers in Washington. In the meantime, it's up to civil society, it's up to individuals of conscience, including people who are resisting the wave of racism and right-wing extremism that we have to expect in the Trump era, to continue to push to expand the growing circle of those who believe in complete equality of rights for Palestinians and Israelis. The activism that seems to be so sporadic has actually helped to change the discourse. Don't underestimate the effect of things like Israeli Apartheid Week. Don't underestimate the effect of work of groups like JVP or SJP or others, the campaign to end the occupation. They're small. They have almost no funding. They don't have anything like the platoons of lawyers that the other side has. They don't have anything like the big billionaires funding everything they want to do that the other side has. But they are actually affecting change, which the other side is not succeeding in doing. And that's the remarkable thing. This means not being discouraged by well-funded, well-oiled campaigns against things like BDS. This means continuing campaigns like BDS. The reason that they are important is because they have had an impact on raising consciousness over these issues. I don't actually expect a significant boycott or divestment or governmental sanctions against Israel from this country in the foreseeable future. Some of those things will happen in Europe, where public opinion is more in tune with the politicians and where steps are being taken in that direction in various countries and by the EU. It doesn't matter. That's not the point. The point is this has opened up the issue in ways that were unimaginable 10 years ago. That's why we've had these public opinion changes. The situation on the ground, of course. The greater accessibility to information, of course. The fact people are younger and, like you, are smarter than their elders. I hate, it's true. You're more worldly and you have better access to certain diverse sources of information. Finally, it means that other forms of organizing and activism, things that don't come naturally to many of us. I mean, the idea of exerting pressure on my elected representative to live up to their ideals of freedom and whatever, it doesn't sit well.
But if you watch what happens with the Affordable Care Act, you're going to see the grassroots burning the ground under the feet of those congressmen and women and senators who are going to try and deprive people of health care. That's just, you know, ordinary grassroots activism to hold elected officials accountable. We have the potential to do the same thing on this issue. It's not true in every district. It's not true of every senator. But there are lots of them who are reachable. Lots and lots of them. That requires work. I'm not suggesting I'm going to do it. I am not. I have a day job. And I have a lot of other stuff to do. I'm not suggesting you all have to do it. But that should be in our minds. It works. It's already working. And it will continue to work. It's necessary because nobody else but us is going to do this kind of work. Nobody else is going to help hold Israel accountable for its violations of international law and for its systematic denial of Palestinian national human rights and for obstructing a future in which both of these peoples can live in genuine peace and real security. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Columbia University Professor Rashid Khalidi speaking on Palestine in the Age of Trump at Columbia University during Anti-Apartheid Week in the spring of 2017. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Originally was about moral principles. Should we decide on moral principles? Neil Kinnock was rejected by this electorate, by the British electorate, on two separate occasions. He then resigned, went off to the European Commission, and took upon himself greater powers than our Prime Minister. Is it morally right that a man who is unelected and rejected by the British population then takes upon himself more power? Is it morally right that the European Commission have spent the last 3 years negotiating in secret the TTIP, with the Bilderberg Group at their backing? Is it morally right that these people have power over us and we don't have the democratic right to get rid of these people that we don't want?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. George Orwell said, "He who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past." for our final show from the good old Beacon Centre at the City Academy and Russelltown Avenue, we take a look at the statue mania gripping the United States and what it says about somewhat hand-fisted attempts to control history by today's deep state control freaks. Also, as Bristol schools prepare to start a new academic year with about 1,000 less teachers, we look again at the privatisation of education, the infantilism of the mainstream media churnout, and austerity as the unhinged elite's key weapon against the 99%. Plus, in the wake of the Barcelona attacks, are there fascists hiding in European police forces? We know all about the Golden Dawn in Greece, or you should do if you don't. And could they be killing terror suspects? Not because they're dangerous, but because the police don't want to have to face a trial. Forget the BBC, who never question what the security forces tell. How does former German security minister Andreas von Bülow think that modern terror operations are carried out? Our sister show Dialects back again on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week we take a trip over to Stroud to discover it was here and not up north that the Industrial Revolution really began. The first of the world's dark satanic mills are now mostly converted to luxury flats. Plus former CIA agent Susan Lindauer on the Charlottesville backstory. That's Dialect at noon every Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, let's start by looking at some pretty much unreported news, and that is about the Russian economy.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is the fact that the Russians this week paid off the debt that was owed from the Soviet era, and are now clear of all the debts of that
era.
It's
a bit like about 2009, I think it was, that Gordon Brown finally paid off the Lend-Lease from the Second World War to the US.
Mm. Well, obviously, because of the sanctions on Russia, they've been having to reconsider their relations with the rest of the world. They're a big country, they've got a lot of resources. They were in a pretty much free fall in the 1990s, which is when most of this debt was run up. And they haven't completely written off the whole of their debt, but the debt from the Soviet era is now gone. And, of course, they're trying to basically allow themselves to be free of outside pressures because they've conceived that that's going to lead to them losing geopolitically if they're not.
There are two add-ons to this. One is that they also took on the debt of a lot of other ex-Soviet countries who simply refused to pay it. The Russians said, oh, well, OK, Moscow will pay them, which is a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians actually owe a lot of money to the Russians, which was lent to them when they were in trouble.
This is more recent.
But they're not paying, and the Russians are taking to the court in London to get them to pay, and of course if they don't pay then the courts in London will be shown to be biased and so on and so forth.
The other thing
should lead to other countries refusing to pay.
The other things the Russians have done is actually to forgive quite a lot of countries that had that the Soviet era had lent money to, forgive them their debt completely. Like, for example, tens of millions, hundreds of millions loaned to Cuba. They've said, oh, you don't have to pay that. So they've actually done rather well, haven't they, really, in that they're now in a situation where this debt has gone. There is still some remaining, but the likelihood surely now is that the Russian economy is going to start to take off.
Well, then, yeah, they're still dependent on relations with the West. If there's a crash in China, for example, the Russians will feel it, and we will feel it. We're all related. Everything's related
but
to everybody
far
else.
Less, they haven't got that debt anaconda strangling them like we have with our $1.5 trillion debt.
Well, no, yes, well, we've got a debt, but we've also got a very good credit rating, and we can print our own currency. So there's no chance of a British default, in fact. So, you know, that's delusionary. The problem is that there's too much debt in the world. It's been run up for many years.
They've been talking in the US about the debt ceiling as well this week,
yeah,
haven't they?
Yeah.
So why is the debt ceiling important? Well, it seems to me that you've got a situation where the banks will simply, some countries, if they think that they can bamboozle through massive extra debts, they'll then say, oh, OK, well, we'll allow quantitative easing in order for you to be able to pay some of that back. It's not a realistic situation, is it?
Well, what happens is there's no fairness in it. Big countries, strong countries, countries that the West likes, they get let off their debts. So Poland and Egypt, for example, both let off 50% of their debts. Poland in 1990 because as a reward for Solidarnosc. Egypt in 1991 as a reward for supplying a military to invade Kuwait and kick out the Iraqis. But that was nothing to do with, it was just a political decision. And of course political decisions are made to let some people off debts and other people not. The Greeks voted in 1953, as did various other countries, for Germany's debts to all be wiped out and for the slate to be wiped clean. Germany seems to forget that as it squeezes the stone yet again in Greece.
Okay, so also Steve Bannon's resignation happened just after the show finished last week. And that Trump presidency we fought for says zero hedge is over. Various people saying similar sorts of things, that actually he was the last person who was really there sticking up for Trump, and he's now gone.
Well, I mean, I was never a supporter of Trump anyway, and anybody who voted for Trump expecting that he was going to defy Wall Street and the Pentagon are absolutely deluded. Well, he isn't defying them, is he?
One of the US analysts, Mike Krieger, has said that it's now the Goldman Sachs presidency.
And also the Pentagon. Don't forget that all these generals have now... Trump for years and years and years says we're going to get out of Afghanistan. He's changed his mind. No, we're going to double down on Afghanistan. And that's because he's basically a puppet. He was always a puppet, even when he pretended he wasn't a puppet, so that people would vote for it.
Does it matter? I mean, surely all these presidents...
Well, it does matter in the long run, of course. If you've got a country that's run by puppets of the military-industrial complex with no democratic accountability, ultimately, when it comes to World War III and you're fighting the Russians who have actually built a democratic state which is solvent, you're going to lose. That's how important it is.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour about terror operations. We were talking last week a lot about the Barcelona, some of the anomalies in there. The main one, I suppose, is because there's no main survivors from these main so-called attacks, that there is never going to be any kind of court case.
Well, the other thing, that's very obviously important, because if everybody's dead, then there's never any jury to look at anything. And, of course, the mastermind now turns out to be this Iman, which the authorities in Spain have been warned about by the Belgian authorities. So it looks like, to me, as if this could be a let-it-happen-on-purpose rather than a made-it-happen-on-purpose attack. But, of course, the suspicion has always got to be with these attacks that there is a role for the state security forces and intelligence services. And when the police investigate these attacks, they've got to bear that in mind, because the track record is, going back decades, that NATO intelligence services foment terrorism, including Islamist terrorism.
Is it possible there are fascists in the Spanish police?
Yes, it's very possible. Don't forget, Spain was a fascist country until 1978, and the police are the place where, not so much the Catalonian police, but it doesn't really matter. The fact is that we still don't know exactly what's happened here. It's obviously extremely regrettable and unpleasant, and to be condemned, whoever's behind it. But in recent years, British special forces and intelligence services have been arming and training jihadis in Jordan and in Turkey, and then we claim, oh, what happened here? These jihadis are blowing things up. Well, that's because we've been helping them to do that.
Now, Chris Bolin is an author of Solving 9/11 and various other books. He's just got another one out recently as well. But he spoke a while ago to Sean Stone, the son of Oliver Stone, the filmmaker, who does something called the Buzzsaw program in the US. And he was writing about 9/11 pretty much straight away after. But he is talking about his experience actually just directly after 9/11, writing about it, and also about the modern terror operations today. He was told that there are three main areas that are involved in planning these operations. There's one is the planners, the architects, the people who brainchild, the masterminds, if you want. Then there's a kind of managerial level, which is where these plans are carried out. And thirdly, a working level, where Martin, he talks about the Arab hijackers, for example, just being the working level. In other words, you won't see anything about how the attack was coordinated if you look at them.
No.
So is that your analysis?
Well, I mean, it's similar to Tarpley's analysis of the moles, who are the perpetrators, the real perpetrators, the technicians who actually carry out the attacks, and the patsies, the people who get the blame. And all three strands have to be coordinated for these terror attacks to work. And this goes back to Gladio in the 1940s and onwards, and this is standard NATO operating procedure.
OK, well, there will be no show. This show won't be happening next week because the radio station is moving over to the Eastern Community Centre, but... We'll be talking quite a lot more about this kind of thing then in 2 weeks' time when we have a special about terrorism and 9/11. In the meantime, though, here's Chris Bolin talking about his experience immediately as a writer after 9/11 and a journalist.
I was writing these articles in my little home in Schaumburg, Illinois, in September, October, and November of 2001, as the country was going to war. And I saw that the government and the media were giving us this really false narrative. And all the evidence that contradicted that was being swept under the table. And they're going to war on that. And I said, how safe can it be for me to be here? Yeah. So we went to Germany. I transferred and started working as a foreign correspondent in Germany after Thanksgiving in 2001. And the first person I met in Germany was basically Andreas von Bülow. I met him at his house. And he was the former German parliamentarian who was in charge of the budgets for the intelligence agencies in Germany. And I spoke to three people like him. And they all told me that it looked like a Hollywood deception. They couldn't understand why a Blue Ribbon investigation wasn't happening. And Andreas von Bülow explained to me that in this kind of operation, there's an architectural level, a managerial level, and a working level. And the working level is part of the deception. So like the 19 Arabs, for example, who were on the planes and not on the planes, whatever, the false trail of these 19 Arabs, that is the one part of the deception. But the managerial level, you would find people like Alvin K. Hellerstein, the judge in New York, who oversaw the tort litigation, in which all 3,000 cases were settled out of court. There will never be a 9/11 trial. All the victims' families were settled out of court. Mm-hmm. Even the 100 families that held out mm-hmm. for a trial, they were all settled out of court.
Right.
And of course, Michael Chertoff, he's the head cop. How do you sue the head cop? But in any case, he was the guy who was supposed to prosecute the crime. There was no 9/11 trial. There never will be.
Right.
Because if there were a trial, there would be legal discovery. And we could ask questions like, how did these guys get on the plane? Did they get on the plane? Let's see the videos, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pretty good summary of the way these things work. And if people are interested in this, they should look up the term Gladio, because that's the historical name for NATO's secret false flag terrorist operations which were operating in Western Europe from the 1940s onwards. So there's a pattern here. 9/11 didn't come out of a blue sky.
But it does seem that there's been this increase in terrorist attacks, even though there's been lots more surveillance, there's a whole load more of various rights and powers that the police have, and yet the terrorist attacks are increasing.
Yeah, well, that's the purpose of these attacks. The purpose of the attacks is to allow a police state to be put in place. So the more attacks there are, the more the security services demand powers, resources, etc. And, of course, they're the ones who are ultimately allowing and making these things happen.
False flag terrorism has now become the new norm. After 9/11, that's the seminal event of our time. But afterwards, like the recent events in Denmark and in Paris and in Kenya, most of these attacks are more of the same, false flag terrorism. And so what I recommend to your viewers, is that they read Jean Le Carré's book, The Little Drummer Girl. Because in that book, it was written with the help of the Mossad. They explain in the 1980s exactly how Israel sets up such things like the Paris shooting or the Danish shooting and how they do it. And 9/11. I mean, for example, the six or seven so-called Arab terrorists who were living in Florida all had duplicate licenses issued in their name. You see? So somebody else was going around town leaving a trail in their name. And that's what Little Drummer Girl is all about, how they do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, now when we see Islamic State committing atrocities week after week, day after day, what's interesting to note is that all of the video evidence, is coming out of one little Israeli website called Site Intelligence Group. I think it's based in McLean, Virginia. And the woman who runs it is named Rita Katz. And she was on CNN when the second American beheading video was shown on TV. Mm-hmm. She told on CNN, she explained that it just so happens that we aired this film before the group aired the film because we had a copy beforehand. Well, how did they have a copy beforehand?
that's a very good question. People should look at Rita Katz's site website. That is the source of most of the Islamic State's propaganda, and it's run by an ex-Mossad intelligence agent. Go figure.
And Barcelona, we were told to tweet Katz, weren't we, instead of... was this some sort of an in-joke? What's that about?
Well, I don't think that's necessary. That's just a coincidence, Tony.
OK, but in Germany, we had a near attack a few months ago, didn't we, where a German soldier was found to have been actually planning an attack himself in Vienna Airport. In a similar sort of way to...
Well, he created a false identity as a Syrian refugee, but the police managed to catch him. And that's the answer to this. The police, the democratically responsible police forces of the world, have to get off their hands and start looking at the intelligence services
as
sources of terrorism.
Martin, you know as well as I do, even senior police, senior detective inspectors, etc., are told, sorry, it's national security, and they have to just get out of the way.
Well, what they have to do is say that's not good enough. In Colombia a few years ago, the National Police raided army headquarters to thwart Operation Dragon, which had been put together by the Colombian army. They were going to assassinate all the trade union leaders in the country over a two-week period. The police thwarted it. Nobody was ever punished, of course. And that's the problem. Even if the police act,
I mean, even
if the police try to act,
then they're trumped, aren't they, by people like the security services.
Well, that's one of the reasons why the Provisional IRA wouldn't trust the police from 1969 onwards and killed hundreds of them. But then, of course, they decided in the end that was a mug's game and they gave it up. But people need to realise that those are the choices.
And what about the end of the IRA campaign came not long after they started blowing up places in the City of London? So it was a financial reason in some ways.
Well, the attack on the Baltic Exchange led to a situation where you couldn't get private sector insurance against terrorist attack in Britain. And at that point, Major picked up the hotline to the IRA and said, it's about time we had a chat.
Up but nothing!
Of Irish laddies were knocking up some tricks. They thought Horatio Nelson had overstayed a mite, so they helped him on his way with some sticks of jelly kite. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. All along O'Connell Street the stones and royal fool. As up went Nelson and the bill. The Irish population came from miles around to see the English hero lying on the ground. The Dublin Corporation had no funds to have it done, but the pillar blew to pieces by the ton, ton, ton. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. All along O'Connell Street the stones and royal flew. A crowd of lads and lassies from a dance nearby came out to see the bits of Nelson lying all about. A gusser from the boom says we'll have to have a care in case the corporation put King Billy there. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. All along O'Connell Street the stones and royal flew. As up went Nelson and the pillar too. Up went Nelson and the pillar too. Up went Nelson and the pillar too.
That was number one in the Irish charts for several weeks back in 1966 when Nelson's pillar in O'Connell Street in Dublin was blown up by the IRA. after there'd been a bit of a discussion and a debate. And I just thought it might be interesting to start our discussion because I've got Christine Townsend from the Celtic Colston Group, a former teacher, and also William Brown from Bristol National Union of Teachers in the studio. Just to start our discussion is about to have a little look at this whole incident in Ireland where the IRA decided that they'd had enough of Nelson looking down on Dublin. I dug up an old report which was just a year or so before Nelson's Pillar was blown up by famous the guy that used to fly around the world, Alan Wicker, did an interview over there, which may have even been partly involved in precipitating the IRA to decide to finally do something about it. But anyway, here's Alan Wicker now.
Well, let's say a lot of us are not enamoured of what he represents or the philosophy or frame of mind that erected the column in the first place.
So what do you want to see happen to him?
What I would like to do would be to put a plaque, something to this effect, that this monument was erected by an alien ascendancy. In its shadow, Pierce and Connolly fought to end that ascendancy. Let us salute their memory and strive to complete their work.
But you wouldn't do anything to Nelson himself. You'd leave him there in all his composure.
You're trying to put a half Nelson on me now. I'm not quite too sure about that. There's the attitude of mind of the genuine 100% Dubliner, who feels, particularly if he's away from Dublin, a certain nostalgia for his native city. And one of the outstanding landmarks to him is that column sticking up skywards. He has no love for Nelson, or he has no love for what Nelson represented. But he has an affection for, the irreverent phrase is sometimes being used, an affection for the one-eyed, one-armed old adulterer.
We have no objection to to Nelson in himself. We do have an objection to his present location. Put him up in the Phoenix Park, because I think the further away from him you are, is the nearer he might come to a thing of beauty.
The one-armed, one-eyed old adulterer, they called him in Ireland. He didn't last very long after that interview. Now, the whole business of whether a statue should be allowed to left has really kind of exploded in the US. I noticed, Christine, that the University of Texas in Austin overnight actually took down quite a lot of statues of people who were sort of supporters of the Confederacy, but some of them were were governors of the state after the whole Civil War had long finished, or sort of 10, 15 years afterwards. So this is a bit of a contentious issue, isn't it?
Well, it has, and you're right. It's kind of taken us all a bit by surprise, maybe, in Bristol and in Britain. But, you know, certainly I have learnt a lot more about Confederate statues, about numbers, about when they were put up, about the fact that a lot of them are hollow when they were mass-produced. So the act of, and the unfortunate incidents that are going on in America, and the kind of the social sort of unrest around these statues, what it actually is doing is bringing out the history that those that would argue they should be kept actually is bringing out some history that maybe people didn't know. I certainly didn't know that they were put up at certain times in the last century, or that a lot of them are hollow.
It's interesting, isn't it? Well, tell us about that hollow. Why are they hollow, some of them? Why is that significant?
Well, because if you watch some of the footage of when these statues are toppled, they buckle. So I saw an online video about this guy that was explaining why it is that they were buckled, and they were particularly after the in the 20s and the 30s. And there was this massive rush from towns and cities in the south to get these certain types of these monuments up in their kind of public places. And actually what it was there was a particular company that were mass producing these statues, because marble or solid metal it takes a long time to make, and it's very, very expensive. And so these particular types of monuments are a lot cheaper.
It's also, I mean, less likely to steal them, maybe, if they know they're only if they're hollow, because the metal is worth quite a lot of money. But this is really about trying to control history, isn't it? And that's what your group is interested in.
Well, and it's also about who is celebrated and seen in public spaces. It's also about that, isn't it? And it's about how history is particularly told by one side, if you like, and trying to get the whole of the history much more understood and better understood and better represented in public spaces.
Also, he was saying there about maybe moving the statue rather than having it right in the city centre, having it sticking it in a museum somewhere. He said, talked there about Phoenix Park, so it's kind of out of the way, so it's not right in your face in a public way. But what do you think about the rights and wrongs of what's been going on in the US? This is this is where this story kind of started, didn't it, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, on a personal level, there's something about young people, older people, all sorts of different people, thinking about why that particular person is there in the middle of their, in the centre of their town. Who is that person? What did they do? And do we want to continuously see that particular person, or should there be somebody else there? And, history and the way in which history is remembered and researched and different points of what happened in the past, that comes out all the time.
Well, the guys over in Dublin talking to Alan Wicker, and they were I think it was in the song, actually, saying that if we're not careful, they'll put King Billy up in the middle of Dublin. Now, he was one of the big enemies, really, of the ordinary Irish people. He was one of the people that went and fought over there, and then we were discussing last week about the English Civil War on here, and the statue of Charles I, where when Cromwell won the English Civil War, he said, you've got to take this statue down. But the guy, instead of melting it down, actually hid it, buried it or something. And then once the restoration happened, the statue came back up again. So this is actually it's about the present. I think I just love that George Orwell quote where he talks about the what is it? I'll just read it out again because I like it so much. He who controls, of course, it starts with a he. He who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. And it seems that's where we are at the moment. This whole business about if you are able to say these are important figures from the past now, you're starting to define the whole direction of society.
Yes, I would agree. And I think it's also important to remember who it was that defined who was important at the time. Because certainly when the Confederate statues went up, well, the civil rights movement hadn't started, had it? And so there wasn't universal suffrage in the United States. When the Colston statue went up, it was before women got the vote. So it wasn't a democratic decision. It wasn't something that was by the people for the people. These were monuments to people that were considered to be good people, elite people, people that wanted to be remembered by a particular faction of society. And that's also part of the historical understanding.
When did the Colston statue go up? Do you know?
Late 19th century.
Okay, so that was before there was any kind of universal suffrage at all. So you had to have a property. You had to own a certain amount of property in order to vote. So it's even worse than just women. It's almost everybody not being able to vote. This is when we had all the rotten boroughs and this kind of thing. Interesting stuff. Anyway, so I've been reading recently about Christopher Columbus and statues of him. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I did read an article around what it actually says under some of these statues about Christopher Columbus discovered these lands as if the native inhabitants didn't exist. It's like this, it didn't exist before white males got there.
Well, certainly the Native Americans weren't very good at putting up statues in town centres, were they, at the time, and making sure they were remembered. And they probably couldn't read and write and this kind of thing. So that technology around building, architecture, town planning, and also literature is really about what this is about. It's about not about what people were feeling and thinking at the time. It's about who's got control of that technology.
Yeah, of course. And who and what messages are going to go into the future? Because, this is part of the furniture, if you like, of the towns and the cities in which we live. And that has deep kind of subconscious impacts on the way that people think and feel about themselves and about their city and about others that they're living with. And that is what statues are about. That's what street furniture is. That's why we have these blue plaques, isn't it, on the sides of houses that say about particular people that lived in particular places. There are reasons that these things go up. And it's about who put it up, why they put it up, and when it was put up.
So what's happening with your campaign, the Counter Colston campaign, which, I was involved with a little bit a couple of years ago in exposing, the rather pernicious activities of Bishop Mike in the cathedral with a captive audience of hundreds of schoolchildren when he was questioning as to whether it seemed as if whether Edward Colston was even involved in making money from the slave trade. He said this was speculation, you know, quite clearly this is actually deceiving the children, and the bishop really shouldn't be doing that.
Absolutely, and I think that that was the latest spark, to be honest, Tony, around a small group of people that are building on what other generations have done in Bristol before. I mean, you know, we happen to call it countering Colston, but this has been going on since I was a kid and possibly before that. And what's happened, what some of the historians have done in recent times has gone back to the primary sources, and they've looked at the actual numbers of enslaved Africans, both that were transported but also those that died before they got to the islands in the Caribbean. And those pieces of research and that knowledge has now become kind of more widely known, if you like. It's in the public domain in the way it hasn't been previously. And those numbers are now actually being quoted because it's clearly the best piece of historical research that exists. I'm shocked that nobody's done that research, to be honest, around Edward Colston. That's been going on. The Colston Primary School is consulting as to whether they feel that they should change the name of their primary school. As a group, we had nothing to do with that. That was something that kind of came off the back of what was going on at the Colston Hall and the debate that has kind of, you know, we've had now over the last 12 months or so again in Bristol. And hopefully, you know, this might be the time when we do get the history out and we do have the permanent displays, particularly in the Colston Hall, because they need to document the history that has been that they and others have made over the last couple of decades around why the name of that building has changed.
I went and had a look in the M Shed at the exhibition supposedly about the slave trade. Well, there's quite a lot about the slave trade in there. It's one little corner. There's no mention of the merchant venturers, which almost seems deliberate to me because it's such an obvious thing to talk about, these being the people who profited from the slave trade in Bristol, who still exist, who are still quite powerful today, and yet they're not there, which I found pretty eye-opening, I must admit. But then also we've got John Cabot, who... He was, in a way, a kind of reconnaissance mission for the colonisation, not the discovery. Can we just say this is a colonisation going on here? You're not discovering something. You're colonising it. You're taking it over. You're privatising it, effectively. You're saying it's ours and we're going to do what we will. And that actually led to the a holocaust, really, of Native Americans. Some quote in North and South America combined up to 100 million people dying because of the colonisation. So this is really quite a nasty, running sore in a way. And to have Colston still being kind of celebrated and also Cabot too, with Cabot Circus, with the Cabot Tower, all this stuff... You know, people might say, well, Cabot really had nothing to do with it. Well, actually, as we've been told here by the chap from the Colston Project up at Bristol University, it was the same families involved in financing Cabot and then creating the Merchant Venturers.
And, you know, the Merchant Venturers are still around. And some of those families are going to be able to trace their families back quite a long way, I've no doubt. But the idea that Cabot discovered anything is just nonsense, isn't it? It's the way in which it's been documented and portrayed and therefore taught. And that becomes part of people's subconscious understanding of their own identity and the identity of their own country or their own city. And that has it's the emotional attachments that go along with that that I think need to be broken down So people need to be able to understand, yes, from the actual, let's expose the entirety of the history and let's see it from a different perspective. But those emotional attachments will take time particularly for Bristolians, to be able to let go and replace it with something else. I mean, the idea that the Matthew ship, you know, we've got this replica ship, haven't we, down in the docks, this wooden ship. It would be very interesting to see what's on that ship in terms of what Cabot did and what it actually says and how much of the entirety of the history is actually recorded in that ship. I mean, I've never been on it. Maybe it's something I need to go and do as a local Bristolian.
It seems to be off quite often. It seems to be away at sea. I don't know what they're up to with it. But yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, though, the merchants are still with us today as an organisation, and they will say that they're very charitable. Of course, the former mayor, George Ferguson, was a former merchant. The guy that's the chair of the United Hospital Bristol NHS Trust, John Savage, is a former merchant. He's now left, apparently. He's not on the list officially anymore, and he's spending £500 million every year of our money. At least he's in charge of that, and he's very reluctant to ever come and talk about it on the radio. I've never managed to actually, well, I put many requests in, never ever managed to get him to come and talk, even though it's supposed to be running a public service. These people do seem, it does have a sort of cult-like feel to it, where, I mean, do you think it's fair to talk about the cult of Colston? Because what people like Colston have achieved is a massive wealth fund, which really means that the people who are part of it, they and their children will never have to work again. They've got fantastic amounts of money, almost infinite amount. Well, it's not infinite, but, you know, hidden amounts of money in tax havens, almost certainly, which they don't have to declare because it's a royal charter. And this kind of material is not, you don't have to talk about it in the company's house. You don't have to deliver tax returns, all this sort of thing, to company's house, an annual report. So it is a kind of cult. It's extremely secretive. And the idea is that they're passing this wealth down through generations.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't come up with this term cult of Colston. This was something that was first written about that we have found as documented evidence, historical evidence, in the 1920s. By the Reverend R.J. Wilkins. And this guy basically had, it appears that he was the one that had looked at Colston, but also other figures, historical figures, and was basically saying, why is Bristol so obsessed with this man? Why is it this man and not these other range of Bristolians that Bristol is interested in? And he was the one that came up with this idea of the cult of Colston. But this guy was, he was the lead of one of the Colston societies, the Colston charities. So he was also on the inside. Not only was he part of the church, which, of course, we know, the merchant venturers are also very, very pally with. But he was also on the inside in the sense that he was in and was running one of these charities. So this guy knew what he was, you know, he had access to things that meant that he came up with this term himself. We haven't invented this. This is something that has existed for the best part of, you know, a century now.
I'm also joined by William Brown, who's the secretary of the local branch of the National Union of Teachers. Before we talk about the cuts, William, I wonder if you could say what you make of this, because it does seem as if there are control freaks still out there. They're trying desperately to make sure that their version of history sticks.
Good evening. Yeah, it is interesting. There's a few perspectives to look at it from, certainly. I think the one of control and legacy is really important. I read in Ukraine, they've just finished a big national process of removing, I think, all statues of Lenin from public places. And that's seen as a real sort of poke in the eye to Russia for what's been happening in very modern geographical politics around that part of the world. Here in Bristol, I've sort of had some experience with public engagement around the legacy of Colston and his statue in recent months. We did a creative writing week at my school back in autumn, and myself and the other Key Stage 2 teachers decided we were going to teach about the slave trade.
So what age children are they?
So this was all Key Stage 2, so that's age 7 to 11. And we sort of teamed up, us teachers went away, did a bit of research, we put together a walking trail to take our children out on a sort of day, going and looking at the historically significant sites around the city. And for almost every single child, it was a total revelation. They simply had no idea that some of the famous parts of the city, some of the prestigious buildings and some of the names which survive come from such a sort of inglorious background, shall we say.
But at the end of the day, surely the best thing to do is to be building statues rather than taking them down. Maybe building statues of people who history has buried or the winners have buried.
I agree. I think one of the dangers is how those statues are presented. I mean, it may be slightly controversial to say, I'm not directly against having a statue of Colston. What I am against is the text that goes with it. So on the actual plaque, it says, erected by citizens of Bristol as memorial of one of the most virtuous and wise sons of their city. Now, I do have issue with that.
Now, you were mentioning also to me, just as you arrived, Christine, about some stuff to do with Jimmy Savile, because there were kind of memorials to him that have also now been taken down.
Well, yes, it's this kind of... what I find interesting around this debate, and we saw this with that there was an article in The Guardian earlier this week about Nelson, attacking Nelson's Column in London, which is why, obviously, you're playing the song from Ireland. It was only a few years ago. I mean, and people can remember the what's gone on with Savile. It's etched in our memories. I've got a list here. I mean, this is just a Google search. So there was a 4-foot memorial of his graveyard in Scarborough that was removed in the middle of the night. There was a plaque on the side of the house where he lived that was also removed. There was a statue outside a children's swimming pool in Glasgow that was taken down. In Stoke Mandeville Hospital, there was a cafe named Jimmy's. That was changed. There was a gilded plaque that was the entrance to his own VIP suite. There were they'd made tiles, like a tile memorial, with pictures that included him. Those were all taken down. And there was something called the Jimmy Savile Hospital Trust that was set up in 1981 that is no longer in operation. I don't remember a massive discussion either in the newspapers or on the radio about people objecting to any of that being taken down. Nobody said you're erasing the history of what this man did. Nobody said, but he gave loads of money to charity and we need to remember this guy. So it's the concept of removing things isn't the issue. It's about the individual itself. And this goes back to this thing around... when statues or when street architecture or when how things are portrayed in museums goes into people's subconscious and it builds part of their identity and there's an emotional attachment to it. I mean, that was a real shock for probably other than those people that seemingly already knew or were survivors of his abuse. It was a massive shock. Institutions across the country, huge institutions, were scrabbling to see how they were going to deal with it. So it's the concept of that is kind of separate to Colston the man, Colston the legacy, or Colston the image that the Victorians have kind of created for us and left for us. And that's what we need to look at. That's what we need to analyse.
I mean, maybe you're just talking about a change in the plaque underneath Colston saying something like he was a terrible man that led to the kidnapping and murder of millions of however many million people or something like that.
Well, that's an option, isn't it? I mean, you know, the idea.
Do we want to celebrate people like that? That's
something that the people in this city need to be having a conversation about, and we are having a conversation. I've never known. I'm in my mid-40s. I've never known Colston to be so discussed as it is right now. And I think that can only be a good thing. And what I would like to do is see Marvin Rees go to our youth parliament and get our young get them to lead our young people in having this debate and see what they want. I mean, do they think that this man needs to be remembered or,
If Marvin can't do it, who can?
Exactly. I mean, he's
someone
the mayor,
from his,
you know what I mean?
from his ethnic background, for goodness sake. I mean, what about the governance of schools? Because the merchants have got a big role to play in that, haven't they, at the moment?
Absolutely. And what we've seen literally this week is certain individual members of the merchant venturers, along with the church, the cathedral, actually expanding their empires because they've taken over the Cathedral Trust has announced they've taken over two new primary schools, Victoria Park and Headley Park, which is in the south. So there's still this empire building mentality, I'm going to suggest.
Well, I think you're right. It sounds to me as if the public sector is being deliberately, the funding for it's being deliberately pulled by central government. And these guys with their massive pot of gold are just going, oh, we'll have that. We'll have that one on the cheap.
Absolutely. Yeah. We didn't see them wanting to take Mill Pond when that got inadequate. The merchant venturers ran the City Academy for just over 10 years. But it got an inadequate Ofsted inspection. It was done for institutional racism and they let it go. You know, I'm suspicious, shall we say, about the actual benefits that certain individuals and certain institutions involved in our education system in this city actually bring, and where their motivation and what their motivation is. It should be the schools that are getting Ofsted falls that they're looking to take over, not the ones that are outstanding. And the two that they've just taken on are outstanding.
William, from the Secretary of the Bristol Branch of the National Union of Teachers, William Brown, leaving the merchants aside for a minute, what are the academies really all about, and what's the difference in the way from way secondary schools mainly used to be run?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is I do need to preface it by saying there are some very good academies and some very good people work in some of those academies. However, I believe, and the NUT believes, there are huge reasons to be concerned. This is, to some extent, a land grab. And the ones you were talking about being selective in which schools they take on, this is a new phenomenon. So we, collectively, not you and I, have introduced market forces to a public service. So what do we get there? We have winners and losers. So there's a modern phenomenon now called orphan schools. These are the ones which no sponsor wants to touch. They might have crumbling buildings, they might have a negative Ofsted result, they might have all sorts of problems or issues particular to that place and its community, which means it's not viable, it's not attractive for what is essentially a business to take it on. Should we allow public services to be in a state like that?
And rural schools are particularly vulnerable to this, aren't they? Because those schools that are maybe, you know, they serve very small communities, and these are generally primary schools that do this, and they might be in very rural. We're not a rural city. We're a city, so we haven't got rural. But this is a problem, isn't it? And what we're seeing are smaller schools that have been there, you know, decades, sometimes hundreds of years, serving local communities, actually are being forced to close because multi-academy trusts don't want to take them on because there aren't economies of scale.
And then sometimes even when they have been taken on, a multi-academy trust, a MAT, they can make a decision with zero accountability about the future of the school. There's a particular one I was reading about, St Martin in Menige, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Cornwall. Small primary in a little village. Now, there's a multi-academy trust based elsewhere in the country, many, many miles away. They are one of the decision makers. The one who signs off on the plan whether to close it or not is a member at the Department for Education. So you've got two bodies who are making a decision on the future of a community, not just an educational institution or whether it's financially viable. They are affecting a whole community who have put forward protests, they've put forward petitions, and they're basically being brushed aside.
Yeah, sounds like a top-down decision being made from hundreds of miles away. People have got no kind of democratic input into whatsoever. But what is it like as a teacher? Is there any difference working in one type of school or another?
Yes. from my sort of current perspective with the work that I do for the union, one of the biggest things which I find myself saying over and over again is a member contacts me, upset, worried, outraged at a particular treatment they've experienced, perhaps. And my first question almost always has to be, what does your contract say? And that is one of the consequences that we are just beginning to see the sort of full scale of. When there used to be nationally negotiated decisions and terms and conditions, you could be pretty certain about what you were getting into if you signed a contract as a teacher. These days, I think you probably need to have some legal background or some employment law experience to fully understand what you're signing up for in certain academies. And I've had horror stories where a member has signed one of these contracts, they didn't read it through, they assumed, oh, I've been a teacher for decades, I'm still teaching in a school in the local area, it'll be fine. And then I look in the small print and I go, no, it's not. You've actually signed away your rights to A, B and C, and you've agreed to take responsibility for D, E, F, whatever.
So what about cuts? Because I remember we were reporting a couple of months ago 1,000 cuts. Is that the case?
That's within
Bristol.
The scale of the cuts is just as bad as it was, essentially. There was that slight sort of acknowledgement from the government that funding could be an issue, and they as they reallocated some money from within existing budgets to sort of help plug some of the gaps. There is no long-term commitment to any serious real terms increase in funding. We've got a huge number of schools running at deficit. The problem has not gone away. They've tried to kick it into the long grass, and the problem has not gone away. It's not been solved. There are no plans to solve it. There is still a lack of admission that we are facing a crisis, which is already real in some places.
Now, I know you're planning to do something about it in September, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah. As part of a bigger Bristol-wide rally against austerity, the NUT are going to be teaming up with the NAHT, the People's Assembly of Bristol, and lots of other trade unions and organisations, with the backing of our Mayor, Marvin Rees. And we are essentially going to be putting out the message that things have not got better, the problem hasn't been solved, and we are hurtling, not just tiptoeing towards, we are hurtling right into a serious crisis, which is going to have long-term damage on the health, well-being of the children in this city
and
England.
That's our future. That's our future you're talking about.
Absolutely. Chronic underinvestment happening now, and no plans to improve things in the near future. There's no light at the end of the tunnel.
So where and when is this taking place?
So, Saturday the 9th of March, we're going to be meeting on College Green. We're going to do a march around the city, come back, and we're going to have some speakers. I don't know if the speakers have been confirmed yet, but we're going to try and get some sort of well-respected people who have a deep understanding of the austerity narrative and its pitfalls. And then on September the 12th, Marvin and the other core city leaders are going to be presenting some of their ideas to Parliament about devolving powers and given greater budget responsibilities.
But at the end of the day, the Treasury's just going to decide, no, we're not going to give you any money.
That's what's been happening to date. People power is the only way we're going to solve this. I mean, we managed to get 6,000 people together for that last demo we did for funding for education in May. And I believe we need to keep banging that drum. We need to make it louder. We need to get more parties to realise what's actually happening. So far, I've gone and spoken to hundreds and hundreds of people about these issues, and not a single person, after they've looked at the numbers, has turned around and said, oh, actually, it should be okay. Not a single person has said that, apart from the one line that you get parroted from the Department for Education, there are record levels of funding going to schools, but well, it's not enough.
Well, I started off by talking about he who controls the past controls the future, he who controls the present controls the past. Well, this is about our future, folks. So, thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Southfield, Stephen Clark. Also to, you just heard there, William Brown from Bristol's National Union of Teachers, and from Counter Colston, former teacher Christine Townsend. Also thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects here every Tuesday at noon. You can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. There's no politics show next Friday because BCFM is moving home. After 10 years in the City Academy, the rent is racking up. So sadly, as a charity, we're being forced to leave. And as I hear, there are less and less numbers at the school. So they're looking to make money elsewhere by jacking up our rent. But we'll be back, inshallah, in a fortnight with everything you paid the BBC to tell you about the 9/11 attacks. But I didn't tell you. With some of the top journalists in the world explaining what really happened, I'll hopefully be finding out who the architects were, how they carried out the attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, and why. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1974 and Joni Mitchell. Do please join us for the politics show in 2 weeks' time. Don't let the banksters get you down. God bless. Where you going?
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. This week we speak with Dr. Nahid Siamdous about her new book, Soundtrack of the Revolution, The Politics of Music in Iran, which describes the legacy of the music of the Iranian Revolution. Later in the program, we'll have a conversation with Joy Tota Hilden about the life and work of her late father, detailed in her recent book, A Passion for Learning, The Life Journey of Khalil Tota, Palestinian Quaker educator and activist. All this coming up. Stay with us. Music was one of the first official casualties of the 1979 Iranian Revolution. Yet, even though it was banned following the establishment of the Islamic regime, it quickly crept back into Iranian culture and politics. Even the state made use of music for its propaganda during the Iran-Iraq War. Over time, music provided an important political space where artists and audiences could engage in social and political debate. Now, more than 35 years on, both the children of the revolution and their music have come of age. Soundtrack of the Revolution tells the story of the central role of music in various social upheavals in Iran, dating back to the Constitutional Revolution of 1905. Malihe spoke with Dr. Siamdous about her work and some of the most important and enduring songs that continue to define modern Iran.
Nahid, let's begin with the 1979 revolution in Iran and how music and women musicians became, as you say, one of the casualties of that major political moment in history. You write that the new, quote, pure society was not going to allow for music. In their view, music had been complicit in the moral corruption of youth. Actually, in the spring of 1979, a couple of months after the revolution, Khomeini said, fundamental cultural revolution all over. He called for that. And he said it was necessary in Iran. He also said exiting the ill-informed Western culture and replacing it with Islamic national educational culture and the cultural revolution in all fields across society demands such an effort that we should strive for long years to materialize it and fight against the deeply rooted penetration of the West. Take us to that moment in history, to 1979, and what he said and what they were planning to do in creating this new identity of, quote, pious Muslim.
Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini at the time said that an Islamic revolution was nothing if not a cultural revolution. So it had to really seep in through people's everyday interactions and communication and the modes of being and producing and all of that. And of course, in 1979, in the years leading up to the revolution, Iran was a very polarized society. One pole of that was the Islamists, of course, who eventually took over and, as some would say, hijacked the revolution and basically took the reins of government. And that is, in a great part, many historians will argue, because of the figure of Imam Khomeini, because of this charismatic figurehead, and no other faction really had someone like him. And so he sort of united people behind him. So Khomeini, you have to understand, is a cleric, a sort of very high-standing cleric, someone who's emulated, who had been revered for many years. And he had spent his time in the seminaries of Qom. And after that, after he'd been expelled from Iran in the mid-60s in Baghdad, and then, of course, in Neuf-le-Château in France right before coming back to Iran. So he's not exactly the type of person who was listening to music. When Khomeini talked about music specifically, what he was referring to, and this is something that really came about in my conversations with some of the people whom I interviewed for the book, what really transpired was that what he understood to mean music was very much the music that was played in the cabarets, in the sort of westernized, or not even just westernized, but the cabarets of the Shah era Iran. These were cafes or clubs where women and men They mixed freely. There was alcohol consumed. There were acts in which barely clad women would perform songs on stage. When Khomeini talked about eliminating music because it was like opium for the masses, it corrupted Iran's youth, he really meant that to music scene. And this became evident because not long after the revolution, one of Khomeini's dearest protégés, Ayatollah Motahhari, he was assassinated. And upon the assassination, some people in state radio, in the most arch-conservative place of state radio and television, they produced a song. They brought it to the imam himself and showed it to him. And after listening to it, he said, "I do not cry much, but I cried when I heard your song. This is the most beautiful song that I've ever heard. And if you continue making this kind of music, I will support you." So from that point onward, he allowed certain kind of music, sort of committed music, to continue within the framework of the state. But as you mentioned, the biggest casualty of the revolution was and still remains women musicians and women singers. One should probably say more specifically women singers, because in fact women have made incredible strides, in part because of the restrictions that have existed, have in great numbers pursued instrumental music. And today, if you were to go to a concert in Iran, you would see many musicians, many female musicians on stages of all kinds of genres of music performing on stage. But what one still does not see, and nearly 40 years after the revolution, is a woman singing solo. The solo female voice is still banned. At the time of the revolution and before the revolution, in the Shah's era, as you well know, some of Iran's greatest singers of all time have been women, starting from Qamar, who in the 1920s already took off her headscarf, yes, and sang to a mixed gender audience, a very feminist song, a sort of anti-veiling song. That was sort of Qamar's debut on the stage, was this super feminist anti-veiling song, all the way through to Mahvash, for example, in the 1950s, who, when she died, Tehran had never seen a greater public funeral. Her death brought forth the greatest number of people to mourn her on the streets. This is a woman who sang very sort of lewd songs in cabarets. And onward, of course, many, many great singers and vocalists, including Gugush, who's the greatest Iranian pop star of all time, male or female. So in a culture where women singers have historically, traditionally been so important, all of a sudden, the Islamists decided that the woman's voice was not halal, basically. And this is rooted to some degree in sort of Islamic writings. And I can explain that if you're interested in that. But instantly, women were forbidden from singing solo. And they were forbidden from singing in general. It was really only 20 years into the revolution that eventually people developed this strategy, if you will, of multi-vocal singing, where women were then slowly allowed to come on stage and sing in plural voices, in sort of choirs or in two-voice ensembles. And that is still allowed, but the solo female voice remains banned.
And they have become also part of the very creative space that young musician artists have created in Iran, which we'll talk about later. But I just wanted to go back to what Khomeini said, because in your book you say that later when you spoke with someone, he said that his words were misunderstood. But when he gave an interview with this radio station, Darya, I believe, in 1979, he was very clear in what he said. He said, "One of the things that intoxicates the brains of our youth is music. Music causes the human brain, after one listens to it for some time, to become inactive and superficial, and one loses seriousness. Of course, music is a matter that everyone naturally likes, but it takes the human being out of the realm of seriousness and draws him towards uselessness and futility."
They made the music, what was it made for, and what kind of feeling did it cause in the listener? Part of the prohibitions against music and the tendency by clerics to oppose music is rooted in Islam, Islamic, and I shouldn't say rooted in Islam, but rooted in Islamic interpretations, because this is all about interpretation. Islam is about interpretation. So basically, there's an edict that says, there's a verse that says, idle talk is not good. And some Islamic scholars throughout the times interpreted that to mean idle talk could also be music. And that was then sort of expanded and people pontificated on it. And in the traditions, it is said that rana, the kind of singing that comes from the throat, that is just for pure entertainment, that takes one away from God, basically, is not permitted, is not halal. One shouldn't be listening to it. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, these scholars are asked, Khomeini was asked, and Khamenei has also been asked, who decides what kind of music separates one from God? Who decides what kind of music leads to that kind of perturbation or that internal excitement that is not considered to be Islamic? And both Khomeini and Khamenei on this point have said that, well, really, it comes down to urf. And urf means convention. So the conventions of society, within society, there will be conventions whereby certain sounds or certain kind of singing is considered to be lahf, is considered to be ghana, is considered to be just for pure, ungodly entertainment. So who decides what's ghana, what's lahf, what kind of music takes one away from God, so to speak, and is for pure entertainment? And both Khomeini and Khamenei on this point have said, well, convention. But within the Islamic Republic, where there aren't the free channels for coming up with completely freely decided conventions within the structures of the Islamic Republic, of course, such conventions cannot be arrived at. So in the absence of freely decided conventions, then the question is, how about outside of conventions? And again, Khomeini and Khamenei say, well, it really depends on what's in the heart of the listener. Mm-hmm. It's really basically up to the listener. That's a revolutionary thought, if you think about it, for Khomeini and Khamenei. Basically, what they're saying is that it should be really up to the listener what he listens to.
But at the same time, they make sure, he made sure, or they made sure that what people listen to is permissible within the parameters that they defined.
That's exactly the point. So within the parameters of the Islamic Republic, certain guidelines will be placed by clerics, by those who have been put in charge of leading society, by these jurisprudence. And they will ascertain what is permitted within these structures, and only from among those can listeners really choose what they can listen to themselves.
And also because they were trying to create this perfect Muslim pious citizen, they eventually thought that the choices that they will make will be aligned with the choices that they want them to make.
Exactly. So they're given a series of choices to lead the faithful, so to speak, toward the kind of society, Islamic, ideal Islamic society. It was more the intention of the music. What was this music built for? And what kind of state of thinking or feeling did it cause in listeners? If that music caused a state in which one had greater allegiance to the revolution and to the war and to these Islamic ideals, if it was committed, they called it committed music, that was okay. But, you know, you also have to understand that Khomeini, when he made that speech to the radio staff, that was still the revolutionary Khomeini speaking, the cleric who had come from the seminaries and was still speaking from that positionality. Whereas later on, as he took up the state and Khomeini became a statesman, so to speak, because he was basically the head of a government, the practicalities and the pragmatism of running a government dictated that he change his position on that. Not only was there a revolution, Iran was attacked by Iraq in September 1980. A long war ensued, and music was needed on radio and television in order to create spirit for Iranians. And in fact, Khomeini, not unlike the Shah, had stated that he opposes music that is very sad. He didn't think music that was very sad was good for the spirit of the nation, and that music should have epic qualities, the kinds of qualities that sort of bolster people's spirit.
And also because they were mobilizing tens of thousands of people to go to war, so
that's
music
right.
became an effective tool of propaganda
and
mobilizing the masses. That's why it became part of their whole cultural transformation of the Iranian society. And one of the first institutions that the Islamists occupied following the collapse of the old regime was what had been the state radio and television, after what you call cleansing them of staff and programming that were deemed un-Islamic. they began broadcasting revolutionary songs from the airwaves. So can you give us a sense of what people heard in the early days of the revolution, and what are some of the songs that embody those days and those moments?
I think no song better embodies that revolutionary moment of the Islamists taking over, the signal that this is now an Islamic republic as opposed to any other kind of republic that it could have arguably become. It could have become more leftist. It could have become a moderately religious nationalist. But no, it became an Islamic republic. And no song signaled that better than the first song that was broadcast from state radio after it had been taken over by the Islamists. And that was Reza Rouygeri's voice with Iran, 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 which is a fairly simple song. The two words that it most intones are Iran and Islam, coupling those things together. And Reza Rouygeri, in fact, has said in interviews subsequently that he was inspired by the rooftop cries of Allahu Akbar for that song, because slightly sort of in the middle of the song, once the beginning passage is over, you hear Allah, 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 Allahu Akbar.
Allah, Allah.
Allahu Akbar, and he takes that string, and the song is sort of formulated around these rooftop cries, which, by the way, are still revolutionary. As we know, in 2009, when the Green Movement protests were happening, people once again took to the rooftops and started shouting Allahu Akbar, in part because this was not signaling that they wanted to return to affirm the Islamic Republic. Yeah. It was actually a subversive measure to state that God, the highest being, was still on the side of the just, of the justfully protesting Iranians who were seeking freedom and a better political system, so to speak.
So what happened to him?
Reza Rouygeri still is in Iran. He's a sort of semi, not really celebrity, but he hangs out with other musicians. He appears whenever there's any sort of commemoration of those revolutionary times, but he also, you can see him in photographs with actors and actresses. Mm. He's not exactly the poster child for Islamism in Iran. He's just another man who, at the time of the revolution, at this extremely hopeful moment when Iranians had come together to topple a dictator, yeah, whom the world thought unshakable, you know, had emerged and sung this very hopeful song, but who didn't exactly envision that eventually that revolution would lead to the current state.
A lot has happened in the past 38 years. Also, leftists played a major part in the revolution. There were leftist revolutionary songs, some of them that were later appropriated by the state. Mm-hmm. What were some of the more powerful songs that were produced by leftist groups in Iran?
There are many songs, but one song that actually also came back was not only played then, but also resurfaced again during the Green Movement in 2009, is the song Aftab Karan. Quran is about planting not just trees and flowers, but also, you know, the woman who's planting these and the man who are planting these have guns, and they're revolutionary, they're militant revolutionaries. Mir Hossein Mousavi dug this song out 30 years after the revolution because it's an incredibly beautiful song, and it's also a very hopeful song where Tuyasinash, John, Tuyaku Setare Mikar, there's stars and there's life and there's hope and there's this revolutionary movement for a dawn breaking and a whole new world beginning. And Musavi took this song in 2009 and became his campaign song. And I was sitting next to a woman who was at the biggest campaign event in the lead up to the 2009 elections. And the moment this song started, she broke down in tears because to her, Musavi's use of this leftist song signaled there was a kind of forgiveness that was being offered toward these millions of Iranians who weren't Islamists, who were of other political convictions, who had contributed to the revolution, but that had been subsequently pushed away, some of them thousands executed in the prisons, and so on. So leftist songs have been used not just by leftists then, but have been recycled even by the Islamic Republic's own personas, which Musavi is.
Right, that during the 2009 protest movement and when they started using that song, there was actually a debate within the campaign whether it was proper to appropriate a song from the past that was specifically produced by leftists and it was a different era, and how they can use it effectively without appropriating it. So there was also a lively debate amongst the campaign workers.
That's something I was told by one of the main people involved in Musavi's youth campaign. There was a lot of debate because some of the people involved thought that it was just not quite right, in part because these leftists had been completely sidelined, driven from the country, and as I said, many of them also executed. So to take a song that encapsulated their movement and appropriated, some of the people in the campaign had problems with it. And actually, the person I spoke to said, I kind of felt like it was like Ahmadinejad taking Yad Dabistani, which is another song of protest. It's become a song of protest in post-revolutionary Iran. Yad Dabistani also hails from 1979, but toward the late 90s, it was picked up by the student movement as the song of their protest movement. And really, it's about your primary schoolmate, the little kid sitting next to you in elementary school, and the thing that binds these two children. They're both children of Iran. No matter what their political convictions will be eventually, they are bound together by the fact they are Iranians, and they will contribute to the kind of nation that Iran ultimately will be. So it's not instantly political in the refrain, at least, but clearly signals that kind of union between Iranians. دبستانی من با من و همراه منی چوب الف بر سر ما بغض من و آه منی حک شده اسم من و تو روتن این تخت سیاه ترچه بیداد و ستم مونده هنوز روتن ما دشت بی فرهنگی ما هرزه تمومه علفاش خوب اگه خوب بد اگه بد مرده دلای آدماش دست من و تو باید این پرده ها رو پاره کنه کی میتونه جز من و تو درد ما رو چاره کنه یار دبستانی من با من و همراه منی چوب الف بر سر ما بغض من و آه منی. This song was taken by Ahmadinejad for his campaign in 2005 and again in 2009, reappropriated in order to get some sort of authenticity because this song projected so much authenticity for the student movement. And the person who was involved in these conversations for Musavi's movement, she said, you know, I said it was like Ahmadinejad taking Yad Dabistani and using it for his campaign. We shouldn't be using this Aftab Karan song for Musavi's campaign. But I suppose her opinion was overrided by others who believe that it signaled inclusivity and was a beautiful song that should be used. They also wanted to use a song that a lot of people connected with and knew, so they didn't want to have a completely new song that nobody could connect with, and so they ended up choosing this leftist song. دبستانی من با من و همراه منی چوب الف بر سر ما بغض من و آه من
And music has played an important role in Iran's political upheavals since the constitutional revolution of 1905-1911. This period produced some of Iran's most enduring freedom-seeking songs, a repertoire that continued during the 1979 revolution, and it was again revived at the height of the Green Uprising in 2009. You write about a group called Chavush, which was also instrumental in reviving these political songs that goes back all the way to the Constitutional Revolution time.
So at the time of the Constitutional Revolution, 1905 to 1911, a man by the name of Arif Qazvini really turned poetry into political songs. There was no radio, there was no television, there were some newsletters and so on. But the absence of mass media, this is something I write about in the book, his concerts effectively became a mass medium for political protest. And Arif Qazvini is credited with creating the political tasnif, taking Persian classical music based in the Persian repertoire of the Radif, which is fairly complicated and usually based in improvisation, and creating these shorter songs, something like 2 to 3 minutes with a repetitive refrain and infusing them with political meaning. He did this in the early 20th century. And then Reza Shah took over and the political tasnif was basically banned, and he promoted a kind of sort of nationalist surud, and Persian classical music was thought to be sort of out of it, complacent. Even in the years leading up to the revolution, people viewed classical Persian music as backward, so to speak, stultified. But then a group of young Persian classical musicians, the best in their trade, the youngest and the best at the time, led by Mohammad Reza Lotfi, Mohammad Reza Shajarian, Hussein Ali Zadeh, and Shahram Nazeri, they got together, and many others, they got together and they formed the Chavush Cultural Society and really decided to join the revolutionary movement. They were fed up with Persian classical music that wasn't part of the people's political and social concerns, and really revived the kind of music that Arif Qazvini had created nearly a century earlier at the time of Iran's constitutional revolution. They took some of his songs, but they also created other songs. One of the songs that they revived, for example, was Hengam-e-May. Some of the lyrics are that from the blood of the youth, tulips have sprung. Oh dear, tulips have sprung. This is a very famous song that all Iranians know. This song was also again revived at the time of Iran's Green Movement in 2009, and people took the song again, I think, in the rendition of Mohammad Reza Shajarian, and laid it over on YouTube with videos of the demonstrations and protests in 2009. You know, people often think, when they think about protest music in the Iranian context, they often think about underground music, rap and rock and all of that. But I think that Iran's most potent form of protest music really is Persian classical music, because this is poetry that many Iranians understand. It's implicit, it's subversive, but it's not super explicit, so people have felt comfortable for decades partaking in this sort of secret language, so to speak. It's secret insofar as it's not explicit, but most, if not every Iranian sort of understands the implicit messages of these songs that call for freedom and democracy and so on, including Shajarian.
Among Chavez's first songs was Dew Turned Into Blood. And it was a song that commemorated 1978 Black Friday.
Chavush took songs from the Persian classical tradition, but they also took other songs from other traditions, such as Jale Hunshod. It was about Jale Square, where during Black Friday, a large number of protesters were gunned down. At the time, actually, it was believed that the number was much larger than we subsequently found out they were. But at the time, people thought thousands of people had been gunned down at this protest. So it was a turning point for the revolution. From that Black Friday onward, I believe it is the 8th of September 1978, that is when the Chavushis signed their resignation to state radio. They said, we're no longer part of this apparatus. We will no longer sing on the state airwaves of the Pahlavi regime. They quit state radio and they went underground and started producing these songs, which were so influential for the revolutionary movement, including a song called Jale Hunshod. Jale being the name of the square where Black Friday happened, and Jale also means dew. So dew turned to blood. What happened to blood? Blood became madness. So describing this revolutionary moment in which people basically turned. They turned and they decided to take arms and rise up against the Pahlavi monarchy.
A few short months after the revolution, the war broke out. Iran-Iraq war lasted more than 8 years. How did the regime use music as what you describe as revolutionary propaganda in the long Iran-Iraq war?
The state decided to make use of music for its revolutionary spirit-making, so to speak, to send all these young people into war. And one of the voices that stood out at the time was Sadiq Ahangaran's voice. He was called Imam Khomeini's Bulbul, Imam Khomeini's Nightingale. He so became the voice of that period. And the kind of chanting or music, if you would like, that he made was emblematic of the songs one would hear on state media, although there were many others too, but they were basically march music with passages of sort of lamentation, of commemoration of those who died on the front lines. In one of Sadiq Ahangaran's pieces, he is standing actually in he's in Jamkaran, where Khomeini used to live, in front of hundreds, if not thousands, of soldiers. And he sings about the marches of Khuzestan, because Khuzestan, the southern province of the southwestern province of Iran, which was attacked first by Iraq, gave many, many martyrs. And in fact, it was taken for a while. And it was a very, very, very bloody battle that allowed Iran to regain control of that territory. And he sings the names of the martyrs, and these soldiers who are facing him are beating their chests. And it's a sort of interactive orchestra. It's amazing. Sadat Ohangaran is singing these chants, and the soldiers are basically the instruments. They're beating their chests. Mm-hmm. And out comes this music that is made of without instruments. And that was the kind of music that he made, was very grassroots and from the ground up, if you will, which is why I think it had so much resonance with Iranians at the time who were part of the war effort. He would go to the front lines and sing, for example, "O Army of this of the Savior of Times," Savior of Times being the Messiah within the Shia tradition, Imam Mahdi. the time for the army of the savior of times. The battle has come. Get ready for a merciless battle. Tie your shoelaces, put on your headband and get in there. And that's the kind of music that he would sing on the war fronts. And as we know, on both sides, something like a million people died, most of them quite young.
Some of these songs were accompanied by images of these young kids going to war.
Yeah, and some of these images are quite heartbreaking. There's one in particular, for example, of this particular song, Lashkar-e Sahib Zaman, Imam Mahdi's army, where the camera pans and sort of stops on one boy who doesn't look any older than 10, perhaps 11, and he's sitting there. And you know, Iranians know people. They know their sons of their neighbors or cousins and brothers who went into battle who were teenagers.
So, Nahid, how effective was this propaganda?
First of all, this kind of music was in some ways novel because it was rooted in the tradition of religious lamentation, which a large majority of Iranians would connect with viscerally because it's something they've grown up with. It's the kind of religious lamentation, Roze Khuni or Nohe Khuni, that their families had either during Ashura for the commemoration of the imams or even at family funerals, that kind of lamentation is done. So this sort of lamentation was combined with more instrumental, epic kind of music, is what they call it, sort of cinema music, if you will. This combination, I think, was quite powerful. Many Iranians you would speak to would say they hated that music and turned off television when they heard it. But of course, the majority of Iranians who do have a voice that penetrates, so to speak, you know, our English-speaking Western world happen to be from the upper echelons of Iranian society. And a good number, if not the majority of those who made sacrifices in the war effort did not come from the upper echelons, at least not from the westernized necessarily. And so I'm not sure how many of them would say, oh, we switched off television when we heard it. I don't think they could. They had sons and uncles and brothers and fathers out on the front lines. And this music kept them going. This music gave them purpose, made them realize what they're in it for, is for an Islamic Iran, for justice, for Islam. So this music enforced that. And that way you could say, yes, it was effective. I'm not sure that any state can run a war in a sort of 20th century modernity without backing it up with music on its mass media.
Dr. Nahid Siyamdust is the author of Soundtrack of the Revolution, The Politics of Music in Iran. For more information and to find the music you heard on today's program, visit vomina.org. Next week, we'll bring you the second part of our interview with Dr. Siyamdust, which focuses on the birth of underground music in Iran, of which you are hearing a sample in the background. This music became a space for the country's youth to speak about their daily experiences and societal issues, such as drug addiction, depression, poverty, and youth unemployment in the face of heavy political repression. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
To a Palestinian father and an American mother, Joy Tota Hilden is a Berkeley-based author,
artist, and activist who was born in Ramallah and came to the U.S. at the age of 9. Her previous work includes Bedouin Weaving, an illustrated volume on the weaving traditions of Saudi Arabia, where she lived for 10 years. She spoke with Khalil Bendib about her latest book, A Passion for Learning, in which she documents the life journey of her father, the late Khalil Tota.
Joy Tota Hilden, welcome back to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. It's great to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
Joy, your new book, A Passion for Learning, The Life Journey of Khalil Tota, a Palestinian Quaker educator and activist, is about the fascinating story of this Palestinian Quaker, an educator. Palestinian Quakers, it's not a combination we hear very often. We all know about Palestinian Muslims, Palestinian Christians in general, even Palestinian Jews, but a Palestinian Quaker. Tell us a little bit, how did that happen?
In Ramallah, where my father was born and all the generations in the family before him, Quakers came to the town. They were on a trip to speak. They were from the U.S., from Maine. And there had been some British Quakers in the region, late 1800s. The people of Ramallah liked what they were saying. So a young girl, actually, of 15, invited them to come and open a school. And she said she would teach. Her English was good. That's the short story of how Quakerism came. They went back home, got money, and came back and started opening schools. They opened a girls' school.
How did this young woman of 15, how did she come to first have the authority to do such a thing and speak English so well?
I'm not sure. She might have gone to a school in Jerusalem or something, because Jerusalem and Ramallah are very close.
You were born in Ramallah, Joy, and unlike the majority of Palestinians who were displaced in 1948 and then at later dates in 1967 and later as well, your family left Palestine in 1944. Tell us what prompted that departure in 1944.
My parents had two kinds of reasons. One kind was the official kind, and the other was the unofficial kind. The official kind was that they wanted us children, my brother and sister particularly, to finish their education in the U.S. and go to college there. I was the youngest, so I was still a little young. When we left, I was 9. Mm. The unofficial reason was that there were a lot of difficulties, some of them racial, my father being a brown man, a Palestinian native. And the American teachers and staff had a hard time taking orders.
He was the principal.
He was the principal for 27 years.
So even though he was in brown country, being brown did pose a problem for him.
It did. It did. He wasn't one of these people who would sit by and go along with things. He spoke out. He was very strong about his views. And he didn't like to be put down. So he did have some difficulties, especially with a couple of people.
So it's kind of ironic that in Palestine he had trouble, but in order to solve that problem, he had to go to America, which is even more dominated by so-called white people.
You know, yes, Europeans. In the U.S., my father did experience some racism. But on the whole, he really fought for his dignity and for his goals. From the time he came to the U.S. at age 20 to complete his schooling and then got his PhD at Columbia and so forth. Generally, he just found American society pleased him a lot. He really liked it, and he believed in the democratic ideals and so forth.
And this is 1906. He came the first time in 1906,
yeah.
If I remember correctly. And even back then, there was more of an open society, more tolerance, I guess, than where he came from, at least in his surroundings.
Well, his big issue when he came to the U.S., especially when he was working in New York at the Institute for Arab American Affairs, the difficulties he had there was with Zionism. So the racism was kind of a minor thing. I mean, he experienced it when he was younger, but he didn't really mention it. as he got older. It was Zionism that was so hard for him to deal with.
In Palestine, when he felt racism and insubordination from his own subordinates, that was not necessarily tied to Zionism. It was just plain old white racism that he felt.
Yeah, and it was unconscious racism, as racism so often is. Mm. And it was still intolerable because it got in the way of his carrying out his duties as principal.
Let's go back a little bit and retrace his steps as a young person who went and got an education, came back to Palestine. Give us a brief overview of his life's itinerary and journey.
His goal from the earliest days, from the time he was a little boy, was to get a good education. So he went to a lot of schools in his region around Ramallah, Jerusalem, in Lebanon. He wanted to go to the U.S. So when he was 20, he went by himself to the U.S., taking a couple of different ships and finally getting to New York.
How did he support himself going to a completely different country?
He had some help. His family helped him. He had five sisters who were all older. Two of them were teaching, and they helped. His family was, you know, of modest, very modest means. So the missionaries and teachers at the friend schools helped him. That was the last place that he had been schooling. And he got a scholarship. When he got to the U.S., he had helped him to find a school. He found a coeducational school in Maine and got a partial scholarship so that he could work some of his expenses off. So he always had to work. In the summers, he got jobs. When he was in college, he went to Clark College in Worcester, Massachusetts. He earned his rent money by helping the landladies with his rented room. Mm. He shoveled snow, he shoveled coal, he did whatever they needed to do around the house. Eventually, he was introduced to the selling of aluminum kitchenware. And once he started doing that, I mean, he had to carry a heavy suitcase of samples around the countryside or the city or wherever he was. That was hard work, but he made good money, and he was really happy.
So this is in his late 20s or
yes,
thereabouts?
Yes.
And at some point he goes back to Palestine.
Yes, he went back to Palestine. He was offered the job of principal. I believe it was 1914. And Palestine was still under the Ottoman Empire. And his father had paid off somebody so that my father didn't have to go in the Turkish army.
Mm.
So he had to go into the reserves nonetheless. So he was principal of the Friends Boys School, and at the same time he was in the reserves in Jerusalem. Finally, by the end of that summer, it looked like World War was cooking up. So he went AWOL. And in those days, you didn't have to have passports and visas and all this stuff. He just left. He left the country and went back to the U.S., married his sweetheart, who was his first wife, and was working on his M.A., starting to work on his Ph.D. at Columbia, and heard about a job in Jerusalem at a teacher training college. The British mandate was in control at that time. He took this job, and soon after, you know, being like the vice principal, the vice director, he was promoted to being the principal. So my father was there for quite a few years.
It seems that his faith also was a very important part of his life.
He was very much guided by his religious beliefs, and he had been brought up. His father had all these children, but he brought them up on the Bible, all the Bible stories. And the Bible stories weren't some faraway thing as it is in the West. And his father would take him on a ride to see places that were mentioned in the Bible and tell him stories about it.
So continue the journey, your father's journey. So he comes back at some point and gets married.
Well, he was married to his first wife when he was teaching at the teacher training college in Jerusalem. It's called a college, but, I mean, like I say, these students were high school age by our standards. But they took it very seriously. So the British boss of the schools wanted my father out of the teaching and principalship, he kicked him upstairs to a desk job. My father wouldn't take a desk job. He was a dedicated teacher.
This is during the British mandate.
During the British mandate. Mm. Yep. So he and his wife packed up and went back to the U.S. and got a job at a friend's meeting in Massachusetts, where he was, I don't know what his position was called, but because Friends meetings aren't run by a director, they kind of ran the programs, the social programs that the meeting had, and pulled together the people of the town who were members of the Friends meeting. Meeting is another word for like a church. During that period of time, the war had started, First World War. So my father, he was too old to be in active service. So he volunteered to be a secretary for the YMCA. They were in the U.S., right. And he left from New York on a troop ship and immediately started teaching them, you know, they would sing. Big group of guys, young guys, you know. He was in charge of entertainment and food and logistical stuff. He kept diaries of this. This was fun to read his diaries. So he was in France for 2 years. When he came back, he found out about a job for principal in the Friends Boys School in Ramallah, his old school. So they went back.
So this is the Quaker school where...
where he grew up.
He grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So he became the principal of this
school. He became the principal. It was around 1926, 27 when he started as principal. And at that time, his wife was showing signs of depression, and she died. And he married my mother soon after. She had come in as a new teacher that year.
This is a woman from the United States.
Yes, my mother was from South Dakota, and she was also a Quaker and had had a religious upbringing. They were a good match.
So you guys never had to experience what most Palestinians experienced in 1948. You left before the Nakba.
Yes.
Tell us how you were affected indirectly, perhaps, from where you were in this country. How did that affect your father?
Oh, it affected him very badly. At the time that that happened, that partition occurred, he was working in New York as the director of the Institute for Arab American Affairs, and they had a lot of interactions with the UN. And my father lectured and wrote. He wrote articles and letters to the editors of papers, trying to educate Americans about the situation over there and what was going on. Because, as always, Americans get a very warped view of what is going on. So that is one of the big themes in the book, really, is showing the reader what was going on with Palestine at that time. It's not just about my father and his life.
So he was doing his best and kind of going swimming against the tide, since obviously there are a lot more people in New York who were propagandizing in the opposite direction, and they got results.
And they got results. He tried, you know, writing letters to Truman and to people in Congress, and he didn't really get anywhere. It was devastating for him, actually. And for those Palestinians to whom he went for funds, he was not only the director lecturing and writing and all this, he was raising money. It was too many jobs for one man. And he not only traveled around the U.S., he went to South America. There were a lot of Palestinians there. I have his letters from South America. Some of these guys down there were so furious that Palestine was lost. They wouldn't give money. So the Institute basically went broke and had to close down.
You would think if they're furious, that might motivate them to be active and give money.
No, that wasn't what happened. They were furious and they gave up. They blamed the Institute and my father. You didn't save Palestine.
After that happened, what was the rest of his life like?
He and mother immigrated to California from New Jersey. My brother and sister and I were all in Quaker schools in New England. The older two went off to college and so forth, and I joined my parents later in California and finished high school there. So my father started writing, and also he in 1952, he went to the Middle East. The institute had closed in about 1950. And he went back to not just Palestine, but all of the Middle East in 52. He went to as many places as he could. Those letters are wonderful. We have those letters from him. When he came back, he wrote Dynamite in the Middle East. I mean, he foresaw what is happening now. He could see what direction things were going in.
The violence and the despair.
Yeah, I don't think he saw as severe a situation as we have now. But he knew it was going to blow up. All the countries were occupied.
So did he live to see some of these countries become independent?
No, he didn't live to see that. He died in 55.
Just on the cusp of things starting to happen.
Yeah, and he was alive to see Syria be free of the French.
What's fascinating about this book is that through the journey of one human being, you see so many epic things happening.
Yeah.
First under the Ottoman Empire, and then the British Mandate, and then Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So he came at a time when everything was shifting in dramatic ways.
Mm-hmm.
He saw two world wars. He saw the Nakba. He saw all of that.
And my mother kept everything that she could. Letters, diaries, newspaper articles. When I started working on this book, I kept finding all this material and lots of photographs.
Joy Tota Hilden is the author of A Passion for Learning, The Life Journey of Khalil Tota, a Palestinian Quaker educator and activist. For more information, visit bumina.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com, connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Forgotten History of the War on Korea, with Jutta Phillips, Christine Ahn, and Jeff Blankfort. The extraordinary threat issued by Donald Trump to bring fire and fury on North Korea has been pushed into the background by the events of Charlottesville and the flooding of Houston. It's adding forgetting to part of our history that itself has been forgotten, for sure inside the U.S., although not by North and also South Korea. the great late folk singer and storyteller Yuta Phillips told us how he became an activist at a meeting in the Unitarian Fellowship Hall in Berkeley in May 2004. He said that being drafted and stationed in Korea changed his life.
Korea was a sea of ruins. Korea was shoeshine boys coming to our fence, and then when they were shooed away, going out and digging a little hole in the dike and the rice paddies drained because it was winter, and build a little fire to stay warm, and I'd go into the guard towers to spot the fire so I could take a canteen cup full of cocoa and tea out, and going out one morning and find one of them frozen, little boy frozen to death, carrying him back in, giving him to the Katusas, the Koreans attached to the U.S. Army. And they took him, but I could see the way they looked at me, how much they hated me, how much they didn't want me to be there. Trying to swim in the Imjin River to wash it all off, to wash off all of the decay, the rot, to wash off this unlimited license for excess of all kinds, sexual excess, violence, booze, drugs, what have you, the blueprint for self-destruction, the blueprint for manhood that had been given to me, not just by my Army sergeants, not just by Korea, but by my gym instructor, by my camp counselors, by my own father, you see. I wanted to abandon it. I wanted to swim in the Imjin, but I couldn't do it. Regulation. Why? Yoon Suk Han, a young Korean who spoke English, said, when we get married in our culture, the young people move in with the grandparents. But there's devastation. There's nothing growing. So when the first baby comes, somebody has to leave. And it's the old man. The grandfather will go sit on a blanket with a jar of water on the bank of the Imjin River and die, and then roll down and be carried out to sea. He said, you can't swim in the Imjin because those are our elders being carried out to sea. Well, that was when it was done for me. That was when it was over for me, and I started running away. And that's when I said, this is all wrong. Everything is all wrong. It all has to change, and that change has to begin with me.
Yuta Phillips. And the change led him to work with transients and migrants and to the discovery of anarchism and pacifism. For the last 21 years of his life, he lived in Nevada City. There he helped found the Hospitality House Homeless Shelter and the Peace and Justice Center. Moving forward to August 2017, Jeff Blankford is a veteran, much-traveled journalist and photographer. Since 2001, he has hosted Takes on the World, a twice-monthly program on international affairs on KZYX Public Radio in Northern California. Jeff studied history at UCLA in the 1950s. And was one of 14 students out of 14,000 who protested the Korean War. He recently did in-depth research on the origin of the war and invited Christine Ahn to be the guest on his program on August 23, 2017. Christine Ahn is a co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute, the National Campaign to End the Korean War, and a columnist with the Institute for Policy Studies. Here first is Jeff Blankford with part of his review of the history of the Korean War, followed by his interview with Christine Ahn.
I expect that most of you, like many of your fellow Americans, breathe a sigh of relief on hearing that Steve Bannon would no longer be around to advise President Trump at the White House. That was supposed to be the week's good news. The bad news is that he wasn't shown the door because of his nationalist white supremacist sentiments, but because of a statement he made objecting to any use of force to resolve Washington's conflict with North Korea, and what was completely unheard of, his support for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from South Korea as part of a deal to defuse the current crisis between the two countries. In a phone interview with a liberal American Prospect magazine, one that he himself had initiated, Bannon, responding to a question about North Korea, told the journal's founder and co-editor Robert Kuttner that there's no military solution here. They got us. Until somebody solves the part of the equation that shows me that 10 million people in Seoul don't die in the first 30 minutes from conventional weapons, said Bannon, I don't know what you're talking about. On the day Bannon's comments were reported in the New York Times, an accompanying article cited reports that Trump was considering firing the man who is his national strategy advisor and a key player in his victory last November. The likelihood that North Korea would invade the South is as close to non-existent as anything could be, but it didn't stop yesterday's New York Times reporting it as a fact. The possibility of a renewed conflict initiated by Washington and the long-neglected history of the wholesale destruction of that country by U.S. forces is the focus of today's program. Korea is called the Forgotten War, notes John DeLory, a professor in the International Relations Department at Yonsei University in Seoul. And part of what has been forgotten is the utter ruin and devastation that we rained down on the North Korean people. This has been ingrained into the North Korean psyche, he adds, which is not surprising. How bad was it? Well, close to President Trump's threat to hit the country with, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen. Do you remember General Curtis LeMay, who became infamous for promising to bomb Vietnam back into the Stone Age? Well, he also played a role in North Korea's destruction. We went over there, LeMay said, and fought the war and eventually burned down every town in North Korea anyway, some way or another. Over a period of 3 years or so, we killed off, 20% of the population. We burned down just about every city in North and South Korea, both, LeMay wrote. We killed off over 1 million civilian Koreans, end quote. Donald Bode, a chemical officer for the U.S. 8th Army, was quoted as saying that on an average good day, our pilots, quote, dropped 70,000 gallons of napalm, 45,000 from the U.S. Air Force, 10,000 to 20,000 by the Navy, and 4,000 to 5,000 by the Marines, who nicknamed the burning jellied gasoline cooking oil. In his 2013 book, Napalm, author Robert Neer noted that a total of 32,357 tons of napalm were used on Korea, about double that dropped on Japan in 1945. Moreover, more bombs were dropped on Korea than in the whole of the Pacific Theater during World War II, 635,000 tons as opposed to 503,000 tons. According to Robert Neer, Pyongyang, a city of 500,000 people before 1950, was said to have only two buildings left intact. This is still living memory in North Korea, he wrote, as was the sadism on the part of those conducting that war from Washington. If we keep on tearing the place apart, we can make it the most unpopular affair for the North Koreans, Defense Secretary Robert Lovett said after the napalm and aerial bombing campaigns of 1950 and 1951. That's according to Bruce Cummings, a University of Chicago professor who's written several books on North Korea. We ought to go right ahead, Lovett reportedly said. Dean Rusk, who would go on to become Secretary of State, recalled that the U.S. bombed, quote, everything that moved in North Korea, every brick standing on top of another, end quote. After running low on urban targets in the latter stages of the war, U.S. bombers destroyed hydroelectric and irrigation dams, flooding farmland and destroying crops. That was according to former Washington Post correspondent Blaine Hardin. It finally came to a point where Air Force commanders complained that they'd run out of targets. Charles K. Armstrong, a professor of Korean history at Columbia, would write that, quote, the physical destruction and loss in life of both sides was almost beyond comprehension, but the North suffered the greater damage due to American saturation bombing and the scorched earth policy of the retreating U.N. forces. Then there's a testimony of General Douglas MacArthur, the storied general from the Pacific Theater in World War II who publicly butted heads with President Harry Truman over how the war in Korea was being conducted and ended up being relieved of his command on April 11, 1951. MacArthur had wanted to take the war across the Yalu River into China after its troops had entered the war on North Korea's behalf, and Truman, intent on keeping the war confined to the Korean Peninsula, fired him. The general subsequently testified at joint hearings before the Senate's Committee on Armed Services and Committee on Foreign Relations about his dismissal, but what he had to say about the conduct of the war has been largely excluded from history books. Here's what he said. I shrink with a horror that I cannot express in words at this continuous slaughter of men in Korea, he told the members of Congress. The war in Korea has already almost destroyed that nation of 20 million people. And he said that at a time when the war was not yet even a year old. I have never seen such devastation, he went on. I have seen, I guess, as much blood and disaster as any living man, and just curdled my stomach the last time I was there. After I looked at the wreckage and those thousands of women and children and everything, I vomited. If you go on indefinitely, you are perpetuating a slaughter such as I have never heard of in the history of mankind. End quote. The United States has never been able to truly come to terms with that havoc it wrought during that conflict, so it has chosen to forget it, an option that was never open to North Korea. Americans know the Korean War is a forgotten war, wrote Bruce Cummings, which is another way of saying that generally they do not know it. A war that killed upwards of 4 million people, 35,000 of them Americans, he notes, is remembered mainly as an odd conflict sandwiched between the good war, World War II, and the bad war, Vietnam. End quote. Nor did Washington ever consider paying reparations for the death and destruction its intervention had caused the Koreans, nor is the legality of that intervention questioned. The same would be true of our war in Vietnam that began a decade later and extended to Laos. None of those countries had ever attacked or threatened us until the recent statement by North Korean Premier Kim Jong-un following the latest round of U.N. sanctions on Pyongyang pushed by Washington. It's well to recall that serious questions remain about which side initiated the war in 1950. Listeners to my March 22nd program heard me quote from a pamphlet entitled Korea, The Lie That Led to War by Sir John Pratt, who worked for the British Foreign Service for 13 years, was an advisor on Far Eastern affairs in the Foreign Office, and served for 2 years as head of the Far Eastern section of Britain's Ministry of Information. At dawn on Sunday, June 25, 1950, wrote Pratt, South Korean President Syngman Rhee launched a sudden attack which took the North Koreans by surprise. His forces crossed the 38th parallel at several places and captured Haiju, some miles to the north on the road to Pyongyang. The North Koreans staged a counteroffensive, and the South Koreans threw down their arms and fled. The North Koreans then drove on across the parallel and staged a full-scale invasion of South Korea. For nearly a year, wrote Pratt, both North and South Koreans had been expecting civil war to break out, and each side was confident of victory. The American Military Advisory Group, he went on, who had created the South Korean Army, were convinced that one South Korean division could defeat three North Korean divisions, and Syngman Rhee had often boasted that if they were allowed to start, his forces could capture Pyongyang, the northern capital, in 3 days. These were ludicrous miscalculations, wrote Pratt. One of the most telling pieces of evidence that Pratt presents was a story told by the internationally known historian and journalist John Gunther, who was in Tokyo planning to write a biography of MacArthur. On the morning of June 25th, he was dining with two officers from the U.S. occupation forces that were running Japan in the post-war period. One was called away from the table by an urgent phone message. When he returned, he passed on to his fellow officer and Gunther what the call had been about. Quote, "The South has just invaded the North." End quote. Well, that was all from a report published a year after the war began by longtime British Foreign Service official Sir John Pratt, titled Korea, The Lie That Led to War, which you can find online. Christine Ahn is the founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing for peace in Korea. She's also co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute and Korea Peace Network, has addressed the UN, Congress, the National Human Rights Commission in South Korea, and has written articles for many journals, been interviewed widely on major media. And we reached her this morning in Hawaii. Christine Ahn, welcome to Takes on the World.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. I have heard you interviewed elsewhere, and I really wanted to get you here And so it has happened at a very propitious time. Last week, Steve Bannon made a remarkable statement in an interview with Robert Kuttner, the American Prospect, in which he said that there was no military solution to the U.S.-North Korea standoff and suggested the best solution would be for the 30,000 U.S. troops to be withdrawn in exchange for a verifiable freeze in North Korea's nuclear weapons program. That apparently was what led him to be fired. This seems such a reasonable suggestion coming from someone who I don't consider to be very reasonable. But what was your take on that?
It was really unbelievable to read that, that there was somebody who wielded so much influence in the White House to even have those ideas was incredible. And the main takeaway from that interview, yes, there was the whole bit about North Korea, but was about the economic war against China. And that, to me, has always aligned with the way that I view the U.S. Approach to North Korea is the real target is China, and North Korea is a boogeyman that justifies further intensifying military operations, more bases, more missile defense systems. The latest one is the THAAD missile defense system deployed in South Korea. That has nothing to do with stopping a North Korean missile from striking South Korea. It has everything to do with preventing a North Korean missile from striking U.S. territories or eventually the U.S. mainland. While that would be a great thing for the U.S. to eventually leave the Korean Peninsula, there have been other demands that the North Koreans have made, namely that they need a peace settlement because the Korean War never officially ended. There has always just been a ceasefire that was signed in 1953 that halted the war but has basically maintained a state of war on the Korean Peninsula for 70 years. And they want normalized relations because they are under the heaviest sanctions of any country in the world, which was kind of offset a bit during the Cold War when North Korea had active trading in the socialist trading bloc. But once the Soviet Union collapsed, that trading bloc no longer existed. And so the U.S., as the world superpower, really put its choke on North Korea. And then, fortunately, with the rise of China's economy, they've been able to stabilize. But still, that country is nowhere that it can be. I mean, given that if you look at the trajectory of North and South Korea's economic development following the war, which both sides, but North Korea was far worse devastated. I mean, 80% of North Korean cities were completely bombed to death under the U.S. Scorched Earth campaign. But if you actually look at their economic development, North Korea far outpaced South Korea up until the 1980s. Very similar to people that have visited Cuba can understand.
Yesterday's New York Times had an article from Seoul by a man, Cho Jong-hoon, in which he was talking about the opinions of people in South Korea. And he said, ask people in the South whether the North will ever abandon its arsenal. And more often than not, the answer is, would you if you were North Korean? I mean,
you bring up Choi Sang-hoon, who is the New York Times reporter. And before he joined the New York Times, he was with the Associated Press. And he, along with two other journalists, Charles Hanley and Martha Mendoza, won the Pulitzer Prize at the AP for their groundbreaking journalism on No Gun Ri. It was a bridge. It was on the southern side. And these civilians went to No Gun Ri dressed in white as civilians so that they weren't caught in the crossfire of U.S. bombs that were flying, you know, across the peninsula. And this was when, during the Korean War, when the North Koreans had advanced south, but then the U.S. pushed them back up north, and it was still so much confusion for a lot of the civilians that are trying not to get in any of the crossfire. But it later turned out that these civilians were massacred, and these three AP reporters, which includes Choi Sang-hoon, who now is at the Times, interviewed a lot of the U.S. soldiers that were in charge of that unit for shooting the civilians in No Gun Ri. and followed basically the chain of command. And they got to the very top, and there was a missing memo from the archives that showed a deliberate message, which was, doesn't matter whether they're civilians or not, they could be communists, so just kill them all. That was basically the message. And that period from during the Korean War and then afterwards, because in the South, very similar to what we see in Iraq or Afghanistan, the U.S. appointed a puppet president, Lee Seung-man, who hadn't lived on the Korean Peninsula for decades, and who was married to like a Norwegian woman. And so they came to kind of lead the country. There was a coup, a democratic overthrow, and for a little bit there was democratic rule. And then the dictator, Park Chung-hee, who had been trained by the Japanese during the colonial period, took over in a coup, and South Korea remained under dictatorship for 20 years. And that happened to be the father of the former president, Park Geun-hye, who recently was impeached by Candlelight Revolution of the Korean people. And it's just, I think, so much of the inability to also forget the Korean War has so much to do with South Korea being also under dictatorship and repressing some of the atrocious massacres and the kind of wholesale killing of leftists and people that weren't even communists. I mean, you look at a situation like Jeju Island, where in 1948, the people rose up because they didn't want to have separate elections. And the U.S. military basically waged a massacre on that island. It's an island off the coast of Korea. And almost 50% of the people of that island were massacred by a scorched earth and also like these youth gangs going in to kill them. And so much of this is because there has been repression. And I think that in the period of the 2000s, when Kim Dae-jung, who was the Sunshine Policy president who came into power and was truly the first democratically elected president, he began a process of reconciliation, not only with North Korea, but within South Korea, to start to release some of those stories. And so I guess back to the thing about the forgotten war, it has a lot to do with America's amnesia and wanting to forget the fact that we lost such a huge war. There was an impasse. The U.S., it was the first war that the U.S. did not win. We were obviously victors in World War II. And starting with the Korean War began the U.S. subsequent failures in military interventions. So I think that's part of it. And I think it also has to do with South Korea being under successive dictatorships. And because of the dictatorship's close alliance with the United States, censoring some of that brutal, traumatic history.
Now, one other thing that I mentioned in my introductory remarks before I called you was I cited an article by a former British Foreign Service official, John Pratt, about the origins of the war, in which he cited information that, in fact, it was the South that had launched the war and the North had retaliated. Do people in North Korea believe that it was the South that started the war?
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
And even I.F. Stone, who we know is an incredible journalist, and he wrote a book called The Hidden History of the Korean War that he could not get published anywhere in the United States and even in the UK. And fortunately, because the Monthly Review Press had just opened up, that was their first book they published. Otherwise, that the level of censorship was so thick that even that perspective cannot even be introduced into U.S. media, into U.S. public consciousness. Yes, and you know, it's not just the North Koreans that view that, but a lot of Korean War historians, Korean historians that go through, that look at newspaper articles, there was lobbying back and forth. There were shots that were fired across, and I'm not an expert on that period, but from what I have read, and what I've heard from other Korean historians is that the war didn't exactly start on June 25th, 1950. that there were actually incursions that were taking place back and forth. But it was June 25th happened to be the day that the North Koreans crossed over the 38th parallel, which then, quote-unquote, became the official start of the Korean War. And many estimate that North Korea did that because they had heard or they had obviously witnessed the strikes that had come across from the south, that there was going to be an advance from the south to the north, and so maybe it was a countermeasure. We can get stuck on this forever, and obviously knowing the truth is important, but it has obviously still not served to end this ongoing conflict. And what we try to do at Women Across DMZ is to try to move the conversation forward and talk about other aspects of this conflict besides the potential threat of nuclear war that would kill us all. But what about the families that remain divided? What about the cost of repression on both sides of the DMZ? What are the huge costs that we aren't really acknowledging when we look at the maintaining the state of war? So that's why we've been pushing for a peace treaty.
Hopefully that will happen. We've come down to the end. One quick last word for the American listeners.
We have a huge responsibility to help end this war. The United States divided the Korean Peninsula along with the Soviet Union. We basically tore a page out of the National Geographic and drew a line across the 38th parallel. We have to understand that history to understand why North Korea feels the need to pursue its nuclear weapons. They look at what's happened in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, countries that had and did not have weapons of mass destruction. And they have no choice but to continue to pursue nuclear weapons program.
That was Christine Ahn, co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute and the National Campaign to End the Korean War. She was born in South Korea and has participated in and led several peace and solidarity trips to South and North Korea and has addressed the UN, Congress, and the National Human Rights Commission in South Korea. Thanks to Jeff Blankford and KZYX for sharing part of the one-hour program that can be heard unedited on Radio for All under Jeff Blankford. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Phil Conant is here. How you doing, Phil?
Hi, Phil.
You were listening to that discussion of Dick Gregory and Colin Kaepernick, our hero, number seven. Everybody buy the nerd. By the way, his jersey is very competitive. It's up there in the top circle. I got news for everybody. We found the front lines here. The cultural wars are as mean and if you're not a smart soldier, you're going to get shot.
And I noticed the NFL is afraid to frontally attack. So the Atlanta team the other day gave a statement saying, well, we don't discriminate and we really welcome all of our black viewers and all this sort of stuff. I'm thinking, yeah, but the NAACP said people should boycott the NFL if this man doesn't get a job. And, of course, he didn't address that issue.
Who's he?
He was the president of the Atlanta Falcons. I guess that wasn't one of the teams that was in the discussion where there might have been a job. But it was like the boycott came from Atlanta. So,
here it is. They say we got the best football. This is why you watch it. Best of the best of the best. Okay, he's one of the best, so he's not on the field, so I'm not getting the best. You guys are discriminating. You're robbing me of talent. All those years that black baseball players weren't playing, we were being robbed of the best baseball. You know, and all the years they weren't playing in NBA, National Basketball Association, we were being robbed. We got to point out that the small minority of white supremacists, they are a minority, by the way. People see them parading all that. You're talking about a handful of dopes. Actually, they're trying to deprive people of the best, and they're working at it here in the case of Kaepernick. Now, Kaepernick, he took a stand for fair treatment of black Americans and other minorities and so-called people of color, and it is a mere fact. You only have to listen to the president of the United States, and you had to watch the behavior of the previous presidents, whether it be Obama or Bush. They had a segregated prison system. Under Clinton, they had a system of attacking black women who were on social assistance. And Clinton would get them off the rolls, you know. Thank you very much. You destroyed a bunch of people. And then lectured Sister Soldier and did all these things. People, let's always keep Clinton in the picture. The last time I saw him was when his wife was running for president, Bill Clinton standing at a podium with his big finger wagging in the face of three young black women and shouting at them, tell the truth. Okay, Bill, the truth about you is you ran a segregated system in your prisons and your three strikes and you're out. That was Bill Clinton. And I'm saying it's systemic. Democrats and Republicans have a little ball game they play. You know, oh, don't play for his team. We're a good team. Baloney. But at any rate, we had an increase of really ugly incidents where black Americans either strangled to death on the street by a policeman showing off his biceps, and man dies, can't breathe. Young man is shot over something, we don't even know what. And so you have a militarized, by the way, that was Obama and Clinton and Bush, all militarized the police so that they come with half tanks now down the streets of poor neighborhoods of America. So then ugly things happen, and who's surprised? Well, of course, Colin Kaepernick said it hurt him, and he show his identification with people over this issue by taking a knee during the playing of the national anthem. The playing of the national anthem is an organized loyalty oath. You pay your ticket to watch two teams play football, but you have to take a loyalty oath before you can watch the game. I am loyal to what? Well, look up in the sky and the warplanes will scoot over and you'll know. And so, I mean, it's ugly. It's a very unpleasant thing if you think carefully about it. They weren't there before World War I. All this started with super patriotism. And you wipe out conscience. You write the ability to say I don't agree, and you can stop telling the world you give it 2 cents for freedom. But Colin Kaepernick called out on this. It'd been a quiet, respectful way. By the way, he happens to be quite a quiet, respectful man. Actually, he is not. He's a very articulate, very intelligent guy. But he's the type of intelligent person who doesn't do stupid sound bites. He actually thinks, and go to his website. Go Kaepernick. He's a good leader. If you're living in Joplin and all you got's a radio and you happen to be listening to CIUT, Kaepernick's your leader. Just check him out. Just go. Just write his name in. It says Twitter. And you will get an education every day. You will be the smartest kid in town. Believe me. Which also means you have to be very careful where you go, what you do. Now, on the other side of the coin, I want to come to this. With the statues, what are statues about? Today's New York Times has a great essay by Eric Foner. And Foner comes by from a great family, by the way. But his expertise is on American Reconstruction. He's written the best books on what happened at the end of the Civil War when black Americans achieved not only the end of slavery, the 4 million people had their chains removed as a result of the Civil War. They could not be slaves anymore. And they were also recognized as American citizens. And they had the right to vote. That happened as a result of a violent encounter between the American government, the Union government, and a group of slave-holding rebels who called themselves the Confederacy. They fought to keep those slaves, and that's why they lost, by the way, but there wouldn't have been a war if they hadn't had the slaves. Now, the statuary, as Eric Foner points out in today's New York Times, the statuary that the president calls beautiful and historic, that's just a myth. There's a lot of statuary, but this was purchased by pro-slavery adherents and believers in segregation. And when they regained power after Reconstruction, Reconstruction was a period of about a little window, about 10 years, during which federal troops were dispersed in the former slave states in order to enforce the laws of the land and to protect Americans, and that, of course, black Americans, from mobs and from the Klan and from those who were trying to reestablish the slaveocracy. So in 1876, it basically came to an end, 1877, 1888, as the white power structure, and I don't mean white people, I'm talking about an elite. These were people who were wealthy, and these were people meant to have power, hold power. Then they struck a deal with their rich friends in the North, and they said, we are now going to have a system where we will run the South in our own way. And that was agreed to. An alliance was struck between the capitalists of the North and South, and it brought in official and legal segregation, brutality, and oppression of black Americans once again. And part of that, to make it clear to everybody, was a statuary. They began to put up in the 1890s all these so-called beautiful statues. And the principal cultural body doing that was the Daughters of the American Confederacy, pardon me. Jesus, I didn't mean to include Canada, but now that we've come to Canada, yeah, no. The Confederacy, Daughters of the Confederacy. Wealthy individuals who were racist and believed in the lost cause of slavery paid for them. And the one in Charlottesville was paid for by a man named McGuire. He owned the land in Charlottesville. And he said, this is my land. I'm going to make it a park. I'm going to call it Lee Park. And I want a big, beautiful equestrian statue of my hero, Robert E. Lee. And over here, I got another piece of land, and I want that. I'm going to call that Jackson Park, and I want an equestrian statue of my great hero, Stonewall Jackson. The people of Charlottesville didn't have anything to say about that. They were not at all consulted. That wasn't their decision. It was the wealthy, white power, said, that's what I want. And the vehicle, liaison committee for this will be the Daughters of the American, Daughters of the Confederacy. And so that's how it went. And that was Charlottesville is just a little example of how that spread across the United States. And it's been a blight on the land, of course, because it is such an affront, an insult to what the all the blood and law and pain that Civil War caused, but also because it represented a symbol of white power. And just in terms of what happened at Charlottesville, we should tell the story properly, because we're getting into a discussion about the mob, the white supremacist mob that showed up there. They weren't very large, by the way, but and not surprisingly, they had a torchlight parade. We'll get into torchlight stuff later, a la Kiev. Let's know something about Charlottesville. Charlottesville voted 80% for Hillary Clinton. It voted for Obama. The demonstrators, the ones with the torches, were shouting anti-Semitic slogans. The mayor of Charlottesville is Jewish. This is get your picture straight of what we're talking about. This is fairly – they say if you're in Charlottesville, you're walking down the street, you'd think you're in Berkeley. They want to make this south, north, east. No baloney. You got a white supremacist hysteria going on. But that was a democratic process. The city council discussed it and voted to remove the statue and to name it Emancipation Park. Well, of course it would be, because the people of Charlottesville have elected representatives and they choose to name the park what they want, not what Mr. McGuire, who had the money, wanted to name it. But you follow guys like Trump and even Obama and Bush going back. Privatization means, you know, Bill Gates, I'm a nice person. Name that what I want it named. Look at the University of Toronto. You see a bunch of names on buildings. Say, where did that come from? Well, guess what? You know, whoever put the money up gets his name on the building if he wants. The name of whoever he wants on it. So this is not a democratic process. It doesn't reflect the community. It reflects money. But in this case, they had a democratic process, and they named the park Emancipation Park. They've already named it. It is not Lee Park, and it's not Jackson Park. It is now Justice Park, Charlottesville. So those battles are won. That's very important to know. And they won another one in Maryland, because in Maryland, in Baltimore, they took away the statue of Judge Taney. Do you know Mr. Taney? Judge Taney is responsible for what is called the Dred Scott decision, in which he said there were black people in America. This is 1857, before the Civil War overturned his decision. They have no rights, none. He also said that the Missouri Compromise was null and void. And the Missouri Compromise, what was the big deal there? It said no expansion of slavery. Can't be expanded. He said, oh, yes, it can. So it was the racist, white power, slave South at that time, Southern leaders of slave states, who insisted they wanted even more power. They wanted to take over Cuba. Remember that they wanted to go to Cuba and capture Cuba and make it a slave area. They did take over Texas. Texas had, under Mexican law, had abolished slavery. So the victory that the Americans won in the Mexican War was to bring slavery to Texas. That was part of the victory, because Mexico had abolished slavery. Remember that. Now let's come to another detail of this. There's two more that got to be mentioned. One is the Army, and the other is Hank Williams Jr. We got a big one coming. Some people are saying, okay, you're right about those statues. Those statues were put up by white supremacists to say, we rule, white supremacy rules. So they have to be taken down. By the way, put them in a museum. Nobody cares whether you melt them or all that. That to me, I would like them in a museum, because I want those things. I want to say, see that? they've taken them down in New Orleans. Lee had to, by the way, Lee was only taken down in New Orleans about 3 months ago, and had to do it at night, when the construction men had to wear masks so that they would not be recognized, because they thought they might be murdered. So, in other words, terror still lurks behind the white supremacy and is part of the part and parcel of the white supremacy network. And so it has to be defeated, smashed, on all those words. Now, the military is a big one, in my view, because one of the biggest military bases in America is called Fort Hood. Who's Fort Hood named for? That's in Texas where it belongs, I guess. It's named for John Bell Hood. And John Bell Hood was the traitor, the rebel, who is in command at the city of Atlanta. And General Sherman arrived at the gates of Atlanta. As a matter of fact, he moved into Atlanta. And he said, these civilians are going to get harmed, so we got to move them out so they won't be harmed. I'm calling on you, General, to do your part. Anybody wants to go with you south, that's fine. Anybody wants to come toward my lines, that they're welcome. But that's what we got to do. But John Bell Hood took the occasion to lecture Sherman. You look up the letter. John Bell Hood wrote to Sherman, and he said, you're trying to install, you're trying to bring the white people here under an inferior race. That's your goal. And he said, and they're barbarians. We've raised them from barbarity. He said, but we've done that for them, and we're keeping them. It's 4 million people in the chains. This is John Bell Hood. So he said, you want us to live under a state involved, your Negro allies, he said, your Negro allies. And then he said at the end of his letter, we would rather die 1,000 deaths than live under you and your Negro allies. That's John Bell Hood. The fort, the United States Army installation, is named after not only a traitor who tried to destroy the United States, but one who clearly put it in racist terms so that no one would be confused. And John Bell Hood, fortunately, was a lousy officer and got his butt kicked just like he deserved. Couldn't find his way out of a wet paper box. He got beaten, badly beaten. And he didn't like the fact that there were black troops on the other side either. That really got to him. But that, by the way, John Bell, that's why you lost. Anyway, so that's John Bell Hood. So why is that fort still called Fort Hood? Now, the Army, they also have a Fort Lee. The Army says, we name these things in the spirit of reconciliation. Really? That must explain why we got all those statues of Lincoln all over the South. There are no statues. Those are statues of General Grant all over the South. There are no statues. And Sherman? No. How about I got one for you? And this is every American should hear this. Anybody listen to CIUT, you should know this. There was a man. He fought at Gettysburg. His name was General James Longstreet. He was the one who turned to Lee and said, don't tell General Pickett to try to charge him again because they'll get wiped out. Don't do it. And Lee did it. Pickett's charge, look it up, bunch of dead Confederates. Not my problem, but anyhow, a bunch of dead Confederates. And that, General Longstreet was considered, rightly, one of the professional generals, a good one, for the Confederacy. There are no statues of General Longstreet. The United States Army never named any fort after General Longstreet. Now, General Longstreet, why? I left out why. When the war ended, he said, we were wrong. And I agree that black Americans are citizens. And we should enforce Reconstruction. It's right. It is only it's the right thing to do. And then when white mobs were trying to organize against elected black officials in the city of New Orleans, Longstreet, who was serving in the city of New Orleans in some civilian capacity, helped defend the black elected officials against the white mob. So he is not celebrated, and he is not part of the reconciliation process. I would love to see a big statue of James Longstreet in New Orleans, because he would be reconciliation, because he lived it and did it. The United States white supremacist army, though, wanted to only recognize white supremacists to put up statues and name forts after them. So there's a guilty hand there. Anyway, that has got to come to an end, and don't buy the malarkey. Nothing to do with reconciliation. Now, the NFL and Colin Kaepernick, they don't want Colin Kaepernick because he says that we black people are not treated equally in America, and that's got to be fixed. Okay? So the NFL says, oh, we can't have that. Don't want Kaepernick. Okay? Who do they want? They want to put a white statue on Monday Night Football called Hank Williams Jr. Hank Williams Jr. is being brought back. Hank Williams Jr. lost his job saying, are you ready for some football? And we all said, okay. We said, oh, are you ready for some football? Then he also said, we have a Muslim president who hates white people, hates farmers, and hates the military, and we hate him, he said. We hate him. And so people said, well, maybe he shouldn't be doing Monday Night Football. So they took him off Monday Night Football. Now they say, it's time to bring him back. Oh, well, wait a minute. You must be the guy who wants to put up a statue of Lee. Because Hank has a song. And the song is titled, If the South Would Have Won, We'd Have Had It Made. We'd Have Had It Made. So Hank Williams Jr., if the South would have won, we'd have had it made. So that would not include the 4 million that did pick the cotton. The people who would have it made were the slave owners. That's Hank Williams Jr. By the way, the song is full of all kinds of hateful little jokes. He would say, I'm joking. Well, we have to say, well, we're not joking, Hank. I think we not only do we want Kaepernick to play, but we do not want Hank to play. Hank decided to go, you know, full bigot. He had a good song called My Rowdy Friends or My Family Tradition. He changed the words to help campaign for McCain and Palin, saying it's a McCain-Palin tradition. Try to sing that, by the way. That'd take a lot of talent, which even Hank, who has a little talent, can't do it. So Monday Night Football is scheduled to bring back a white bigot who thinks it's a joke, and he could actually say if the South would have won. He also, by the way, in it, he says, well, you know, if I put Elvis on the dollar or something. It wouldn't be an Elvis if the South would have won because the black music would have been repressed. He doesn't even know the story of Sun Records. The guy who founded Sun Records says, we need black music. We got to find some white guys who can do it. And they found one. It turns out there were thousands once they broke the door open. And by the way, the Klan went crazy against that. But anyway, we have this dimwit. So Hank Jr. can't be, as far as I'm concerned, doing Monday Night Football. We're crazy if we tolerate that. That's like putting up a statue of Robert E. Lee. And we are going to join the boycott called for by the NAACP of Atlanta against the NFL unless Colin Kaepernick is on the field. Last note, Harry Glassmeek's written a great book called Class Privilege. This has been CIUT, the Taylor Report. Thanks, Phil Conlon, and thanks, Francois. And I think Charlotte's around. So we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.